You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All right, everybody know how this works. When I bring a guest on, I try to play period music so that they'll feel comfortable, especially Vietnam guys, because they do a lot of twitching. And joining me today is retired Marine Corps General Tony Zinni. Sir, first of all, thanks for coming back on All Marine Radio. Really appreciate it. And I've been looking forward to this discussion about discipline sure. here today. So thanks for doing this.
Sure.
All right. Are you a Rolling Stones guy? I picked that.
I go back before that. I'm a Four Seasons guy, Righteous Brothers. You know, that's my hero.
Four Seasons and the Righteous Brothers?
Yeah.
What is that? What is their famous song? What they play? You Never Close Your Eyes. Oh, that's a Tom Cruise. Now it's identified with Maverick. That had to be a arrow to the heart, yes?
Well, to me it was 50s, early 60s. Rock and roll died when the Beatles came. The good old stuff before that was what I listened to. I grew up in Philadelphia, you know? I mean, American Bandstand.
You know what? That's how you learned how to dance before you went to the dance. People don't even know what American Bandstand is, but right, when you had to go to a dance, you had to pay attention on American Bandstand to see how people were doing it, so you might actually get near a woman. And,
that's right.
And that was the way that worked.
All right. You were on one side of the gym, they were on the other side.
And that was a long walk over there?
Yeah.
And it was a longer walk back when she said no, so that's why you had to be a decent dancer, your clothes had to fit right, so you wouldn't have to make the long walk back with your friends.
Most
laughing.
Importantly, your hair had to be combed the right way.
All right, what I want to do is I want to, not everybody knows you, right? So you know that, and I want to talk about you a little bit first, and then talk about discipline. So, born and raised where?
Just outside of Philadelphia, right on the edge, Milltown, led into Philly, basically blue collar community, everybody working in the mills and factories.
How does the Marine Corps, I mean, you grew up in a world that, a universe where I'm sure most of your teachers were veterans, everybody was a veteran. When you went to a Veterans Day parade or a Memorial Day parade, there was no men standing on the sidewalk. They were all marching in a parade, and I'm a little bit younger than you, but how does the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Well, first of all, what you said is very true. My father was a World War I vet. My cousins were all in World War II. My brother was in the Korean War. My brother-in-laws were in the military. And so, you know, military service, to me was something you did. And I kind of thought I was the last kid of my family, youngest. My father thought he could afford the tuition to send me to school, but I had to work my way through college. And I thought that at some point, you know, like after I graduated, whatever, I'd have to do my military service. When I my first day on campus, some guy told me, you got to register with the military. You have to be in the military while you're in school, which wasn't true, but I didn't know any differently. You know, no one in my family had ever been in college. And so I was wandering around trying to figure out, I didn't know what an elective was, all this. I was supposed to be signing up for this stuff and had no idea what I was doing. And we took the lunch break and I was going to the cafeteria and I saw these three Marines in dress blues, a captain and two lieutenants, and they had this table with these brochures on it, you know, kind of in the cafeteria. And I went up to them. I thought maybe it was a place to sign up for this stuff. So I went up to them and I said, where do I sign? And they said, sign up for what? And I said, well, what do you got? And so they're explaining to me, you know, DLC program and all this stuff. And I said, look, man, I got 45 minutes for lunch. I got to get back. So they said, okay. They put me in a room and I signed all these papers. And I didn't know, really understand what I had signed. When I came home, my dear Italian mother said, that was your first day of college. I said, well, I joined the Marines. She said, what? I thought you were going to school. I said, yeah, I joined the Marines. She said, well, how can you go to school and join the Marines? And she said, and I said, I don't know. So she said, wait till your father comes home. So my brother was way older than I was. He was about 16, 17 years older. So when he came home from work, my brother said, "You sign anything?" I said, "Yeah, I signed a lot of stuff." He said, "Let me see what you signed." So he explained it to me. He was in the Army in the Korean War. He was with the 25th Division in the Korean War. My father was in the SPAD squadron in World War One. I had a cousin in the 84th Division at the Battle of the Bulge, and another one that was a communicator in the B-25. And I had, my brother-in-laws were one of my brother-in-laws was in the Marine Corps, so his stories really appealed to me. So when I saw those Marines, I thought, well, if I got to join, this looks like a good outfit. I like the uniform.
Yeah, I could get a date. You know what's funny? How many Marines that, like, those uniforms? I saw a guy who walked into our cafeteria, and I said, "Who is that?" I didn't know shit about the Marine Corps. And it's hilarious. Woody Williams, Medal of Honor recipient on Iwo Jima. He's growing up in West Virginia. Recruiter sees him, and he says, "I don't know what that guy is, but I want to be that."
Yeah.
And fine. So how do you go to the basic school? How do you decide you're going to be a grunt?
Well, in the PLC program, it became pretty clear to me that the infantry was the place to be. I really got fascinated by everything I was exposed to. Both increments of PLC, we had phenomenal platoon sergeants. I just got impressed. And in those days when I went through, all the platoon sergeants were drill instructors that came up from Paris Island to put us through the 2 6-week increments. So these were, these were the drill instructors that everybody ever heard about. And they were so impressive. And then, when we were beginning to learn about what the Marine Corps was all about, the emphasis was every Marine a rifleman. So basically, it was a lot of training out there in field skills and tactics and weapons. And I just took a liking to this stuff. And I thought, when the time comes, that's what I want to do. So when I graduated, went to basic school, that was my whole focus, was getting to be an infantry platoon commander.
You do that, and what year is that, 65?
65, yeah.
All right, so you do that in 65. Vietnam's been going. Where do you go? Why don't you walk us through your career, and then I want to come back to Vietnam. Give us a...
65 is when we were actually in basic school when the Marines landed in Chukwai. So, there have been some Marine helicopter squadrons and some advisors, but the major, obviously, commitment of ground forces was in 65. So they went in while we were in basic school. And then we were told, Vietnam, no one thought that they were going to stay there. The original commitment was to provide security and sort of jumpstart it, but, everybody would be out. But obviously, things were beginning to happen. That same year, the Marines went into Santo Domingo,
right.
Because of the problems down there. And so things were beginning to happen, so everybody was getting excited about it. But we were told, you don't go to Vietnam or places like that. You'll go to another organization before you would get to that, if they could continue building up. So my orders were to the 2nd Marine Division, and I reported into 1-6. Alpha 1-6 is a platoon commander.
All right, so take us through. So now,
all right,
I want to stop there, and then if you just take us through your billets in your career, then I want to come back to talking about lessons learned from your different stops along the way, if you don't mind.
Okay, well, infantry platoon commander, I went from there to the infantry training regiment. As a second lieutenant, I commanded an infantry training company. Went back to 1-6, commander of the platoon, was XO and company commander, and then got orders to the Marine Advisor Unit in Vietnam, went to Army Special Warfare School at Fort Bragg, learned language, counterinsurgency operations, counter-guerrilla tactics, weapons and all, with Special Forces School, and then over to Vietnam, and I was a battalion advisor there. Came back, went to the basic school, taught scouting and patrolling and counterinsurgency operations, and eventually headed that section spent time as a platoon commander at basis school, went to AWS, went back to Vietnam as a company commander, got wounded, sent to Okinawa, was a company commander, two companies, and 3rd Force Service Regiment. So I had an H&S company and a guard company and even a bulk fuel company. And then I went back to Camp Lejeune to 1-8, was a company commander again, became the CG's aide, 2nd Marine Division. Then I ran a special school we had set up that was called the Infantry Training School, which basically was taught advanced infantry tactics and what was called in those days special operations, which wasn't the same as today. It was jungle, mountain, desert, and cold weather operations. And went from there to headquarters Marine Corps, and a tour manpower, command staff college, down to Camp Lejeune, was a battalion S3, battalion XO, battalion commander, 2-8, and then regimental XO, 8th Marines, came back to Quantico, command staff college, was a tactics instructor there, went from there to headquarters Marine Corps and in ops. Ran the special operations, low intensity conflict, anti-terrorism section in ops. They completed National War College, went on the Chief of Naval Operations Strategic Studies Group, Okinawa as a regimental commander, then a MU commander, came back to Quantico as a deputy, but then ended up in Somalia as a director of operations for the Joint Task Force, Combined Task Force. Came back and went to 1MEF as the commander, and then from 1MEF as the deputy commander of CENTCOM, then the commander of CENTCOM. So that's the stretch.
The all right, I wanna so back to the start. You grew up. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I think the step for you into the Marine Corps, coming from an Italian family in the culture that you grew up in, wasn't a huge step. And I look at young people today, they grew up in a culture that doesn't do adversity, doesn't do discipline, doesn't do consequences, and then they step into the United States military. What formulated your ideas of discipline, as a young officer at the company level, in the early part of your career, who gave you, or where did you get your ideas about discipline?
Yeah, I grew up in Catholic education with a bunch of nuns who put drill instructors to shame. So discipline was, and understanding the concept of discipline were no problem. It was a major part of your education when you worked with the Stern sisters and throughout your grade school and high school. And I think also then, of course, I went to a Catholic college in Villanova, and the same kind of values and, beliefs, self-discipline, control, that was there in my life. And, of course, I had a very strong family, and being the youngest kid, I certainly was at the bottom end of the discipline chain, when it came to that. And I certainly understood the concepts of what you're responsible for. I could see the values in my family and my faith and my education system. It was all there. And the whole matter of discipline, and I would emphasize, it's not a matter of discipline. Sometimes people think of discipline as punishment. That was not it. It's a matter, and I remember that the nuns used to tell us the most important aspect of discipline is self-control. And it's very difficult, especially when you're a teenager. But what you've got to master is self-control, self-discipline. And then the second thing, which I think really hit me, was you've got to have a code, a set of values. And before you come into the Marine Corps, that needs to be established in some way. And I think in the times I grew up and in the areas I grew up in the neighborhoods I grew up in, the whole system, that was there. I mean, everybody had a code. What I worry about today, the code isn't there. I had this conversation with General Krulak when he established the Crucible. He called me up one day and said, he said, I'm going to relook at recruit training. And I said, geez, General, that's like the Holy Grail. I mean, you've got to be careful if you start to go with it. He said, no, And the whole concept is based around the idea of young men and women come in with a set of values, a code. He says, we may not be seeing that now. We may have to establish that in some way. And I think the whole concept that he had a great idea about the crucible was to establish this sense of camaraderie and cohesion, and because maybe it wasn't there. Maybe it came from dysfunctional families, maybe families that really didn't function as a unit. They maybe didn't get through their schooling and education at all, a sense of discipline, a sense of values or code not being set. And so this whole idea that we have to relook at not just saying we assume you come in with a code and our job is to hone it and polish it, we have to establish it. And I thought he was right on that. I hadn't thought about that, but I began to see as I looked at what was happening in society, in our education system, in our family structures, and we were beginning to see that this sort of value and code system wasn't there.
You go to Vietnam, so you're a rifle platoon commander, and the job you hold is a junior officer. Then you go to Vietnam. How does your tour as an advisor affect your thoughts on the relationship between the individual and small unit discipline, and also to combat effectiveness?
Well, the advisory tour was probably the most fascinating and educating tour of duty I had in the Marine Corps, because first of all, I was thrown into a whole different culture. I didn't see another American very often. I was wearing the uniform of the Vietnamese Marines, and we were going all over the South Vietnam because they were the National Strike Force, and I was able to, you're not in command of anything, but you're a key part of the organization. And I was able to watch in time of war, watching platoon commanders and company commanders, and I saw a lot of them because I moved around from battalion to battalion, and I was in the field the whole time I was out there, and I saw so many different leadership styles. I mean, obviously these aren't Americans, it's different cultural aspects of the way they approach things, but I watched them, and I could see the different approaches, the different personalities, the different characteristics of leaders, and I began to, you find some that are just so amazingly head and shoulders above the others. One of our company commanders in one of the battalions was 55 years old. He had fought in World War II, he had fought in the Indochina War with the French forces, and he had been a company commander all that time. He was an old, hard-ass, legendary guy, marched at the head of the National Day Parade every year. He was a legend. He had been wounded 9 times, actually was wounded while I was there. And the guy, I just watched how he handled troops, how much his men respected him, and how much they loved him, and the years of experience he had and what he had learned from it. And I really enjoyed sitting around talking to him, and sort of getting a feel for where he had come from. So it was a great experience because of the culture and the ability to be there, be involved. You're in a combat situation, but you're not in command. I mean, you're advising, and you're basically, our job is to get them fire support and make sure logistics worked and that sort of thing.
Right.
So that was a great learning experience because, it made me reflect in history when it used to be that we would send observers when there was combat. So when you think about the Civil War, there were French and British observers and all. And actually, the Vietnamese Marines were formed by a colonel named Croziat, who was a U.S. Marine colonel, spoke fluent French, who was sent out to observe French operations during the French Indochina War. And so he had a whole different concept of how to advise based on what he had seen and what he had observed. And that's why the Vietnamese Marine Advisory Unit was so different than the others out there.
So did your thoughts about discipline and small unit discipline change, or based on that event, I imagine it probably crystallized a great deal, seeing it?
Yeah, and I got to say, going back to Camp Lejeune before I went out there, my time at Camp Lejeune, I was blessed that when I first hit the deck out there, I had a fantastic platoon sergeant. I had a staff sergeant who had been in the Korean War, had a bronze star from the Korean War. He was a tough old piece of leather. And the first day I reported in, he said, you know, Lieutenant, if you've got some time, I'd like to sit down and talk over about the platoon and all and how we're going to run it. And I said, sure. So we sat down, and the first thing he said to me, he says, you know, my job is to make sure every individual Marine in this platoon meets your standards, your expectations, your goals for the unit. And he said, but I have a secondary job. He said, and it's to make you a better officer. And he said, if you'll allow me, I'd like to offer, based on my experience, he says, you come with the education. He said, I have a lot of experience, and I really think I can offer you a lot, you know, to help you in your first experience in leadership here. And I said, well, hell yes. And it was amazing the things he told me. He said, you know, you're the officer, and they're going to respect you. Now, in those days, you have to remember, Camp Lejeune, there weren't rooms. It was open squad base. So everybody's in a rack and a bunk, including your squad leaders, your sergeants, everybody. And there were only two people married in the platoon. Platoon sergeant and my guide. The rest of them are all living there, you know, in an open squad bay. But he told me things like, when you come into, you tell me before you go in the squad bay, because I want to go in and make sure it's squared away, call them to attention. He said, if we hold the formation and you inspect weapons, he said, if you look at the weapon and it doesn't meet your standard, you turn to me and say, Staff Sergeant Paul, this weapon is unsatisfactory. He says, because I will have inspected it ahead of time. And so you should address it to me. He said, when a Marine has a problem, he said, let the fire team leader have his first shot at handling it, then the squad leader, then me, then you. Don't jump right in. And he was giving me all these, you know, this is what the officer does, this is what the staff NCO does, this is what the NCO does. And then he talked to me about how we develop NCOs, how we develop the credibility. And I remember one thing that stuck with me from that. Our platoon was on mess duty, so, I mean, all but the NCOs were off on mess duty. And Sergeant Ball used to hold the MCI courses. He would get all the NCOs together, the fire team leaders and the squad leaders, and they would all work on MCI courses together. So I came into the rec room, and they had maps. They were doing map reading in one of the courses in MCI, and they had it all spread out on a pool table. And I remember that in his office, he had every MCI course that was ever produced. He had his diplomas all over the place. And I knew he had taken this course probably 50 times before. But he was making the squad leaders and the fire team leaders work through this problem. And he said, Lieutenant, would you come over a minute? He said, we're really stumped on this one question here. Could you help us out? Well, the first thing that struck me is he knew it. He was damn good at land navigation. Second of all, he was taking an opportunity to make me look good. In other words, so I came over, we went through the issue, went through the problem and everything else, and we worked on it and, you know, it helped them all out. And he said, Lieutenant, I want to thank you. That was really helpful. Really appreciate your leadership. And I thought as I walked away, he did this to make me look good in front of the platoon, you know, or in front of the leadership in the platoon and to enhance my credibility. So, when I went off to Vietnam, I had come from experiences like that. When I was the commander of the infantry training regiment company, I had a First Sergeant Ballou, who had landed in Inuitoc and Roy Namur, World War II. I had gunnies, tremendous gunnies, you know, Korean War veteran guys. And these guys were the rocks that you learned from. You know, and the way the structure worked is, you know, you were worried about the unit, the organization, the goals and everything. They handled all the other issues and individual things that went down. And the amount of respect and camaraderie and, mutual respect between NCO staff, NCOs, and young officers like me were tremendous. You know, this is the Marine Corps before Vietnam.
The Now, you go to Vietnam, and you have that kind of upbringing. You go there, you come back, you're getting ready to go back, and I want to play a couple audio cuts for you. One is, as I think happens, right as you land in Vietnam. And, hey, sir, just an aside, I'm not going to play the audio cuts. I'm going to ask you the question, and you can respond, and I'll put the audio cuts in there. But you know the ones I'm talking about. The first one I'm going to play for you, sir, is you're talking about you meet a lieutenant as you land in Vietnam, going back as a company commander. You're both going to the same company, and then when you wind up getting the company office, and he talks about wanting to inspect rifles. Can you tell that story? Or I'm going to play the audio, and then you comment on it, and then it would have been 20 years later, probably 22 years later after the event, you include that in a PME that you're giving on leadership that I saw, and that's where this audio comes from. So explain the significance of this to you and about moral courage you were talking about.
Well, you know, when I got there and was told I would, you know, take command of Alpha 1-5, I checked in my zone of turnover with the outgoing company commander, and just as I had arrived, there were a number of lieutenants that had come into the company, three new ones. And even the ones that had been there, I had been an instructor at basic school, so they all knew me from basic school. So when I got there, one of the lieutenants had checked in exactly the same time as I did, went through the whole thing. So I was in the company area, and I was, the company area we had in where our base camp was, we had these sea huts, and I was walking through the sea huts, and I saw one of the new lieutenants, and he was talking to his platoon sergeant. And he said to the platoon sergeant, tomorrow morning I want to get a formation, everybody in formation. He said, I'd like to look at their gear, their weapons, and do an inspection, and obviously introduce myself to the platoon. So the platoon sergeant said, sir, we don't do formations or inspections, and this is Vietnam, you know, we're this is war. And that's hit me, because of course the first thing I'm thinking, there's going to be formations and inspections, you know. And I wanted to see how the lieutenant handled it. So the lieutenant says, Sergeant, there will be an inspection tomorrow. So are you there?
Yes.
Yeah. So there will be an inspection tomorrow. So, please, make sure they're out line. So I wanted to see what happened. So I went out to where the formation was for the inspection the next morning, and in a place where, they couldn't see me. And I wanted to see how the lieutenant handled it. So he starts down the line and gets about the third guy, fourth guy, and he says, Sergeant, he said, these weapons are horrible. They're in terrible condition. You know, they need to be cleaned much better than this. And the platoon sergeant says, sir, we don't do boot camp inspections here. This isn't boot camp. And the lieutenant says, there's no such thing as a boot camp inspection than the other inspection. There's only a clean weapon. And he says, call out the troops, get back in, clean the weapons, and you come tell me when they're ready. So I could have kissed it, I thought, this lieutenant, because he's right out, he's coming into his first platoon, he's right out of basic school, and everything he's been taught that he's ready to put into play, he gets challenged on. And of course, that can be intimidating because, this is Vietnam. This is a war zone. He's not coming out with any experience. These guys have all been in firefights and been there. And the platoon sergeant is playing on that experience to try to intimidate him in some way. And so I'm thinking, this is the first real challenge this lieutenant has. And he stood up to it, and he was a great lieutenant. I mean, actually, he was the one who was by my side when I was wounded, and it
was
in his first firefight. So,
All right. The second cut is you talking about scalps. Explain that.
I saw that. What was that about? I don't remember that.
You said that the cut says you were out in the field and There was guys, Marines that showed you some pictures, and then a Marine that had a scalp inside of his cover. And you in the quote, you say, I grabbed that stuff, and I said, this shit will never happen again. I burned the cover, I burned the picture.
Yeah,
so
yeah, yeah, yeah.
So explain that. Will you explain that story, and
yeah.
then why did you include it in your leadership section of combat concept?
Yeah, well, yeah, this Marine Lance Corporal came up to me, and this, again, it just takes over the company. And he was really nervous, and he said, sir, I'm gonna show you something. And he had these pictures of dead Viet Cong, and some of them were women, which was not uncommon. I knew that from my previous story, you know, and the first time I got a firefight where we ended up with the bodies and looking over and seeing a number of women in there. And they had obviously, you know, the women were, the bodies were exposed and everything else, and showing me these pictures. And I looked at this and I said, where the hell did you get these? And he said, well, this was some firefight that had happened, you know. So I said, give me those goddamn things. And I ripped them up, tore them up, and I looked at them and I said, this will never happen in this company again. And if I find any more of this stuff, you know, people won't pay a price for it. And he looked at me, and what I saw was a sense of relief. I mean, what I saw in him is, this is what he had believed was wrong, and this shouldn't be happening. But, you know, it was like, well, it's happening out here. My sort of framework of so what is right and wrong is getting confused, and he needed to hear that what he believed and where he came from in his code, this was wrong, and he needed to hear somebody say that. It was almost like he was thanking me for saying that and for doing that. He needed that reassurance. And so when I see things like this, some of the things that go on, that we've had everything from mob grave to, you know, pissing on bodies and everything else, you wonder where the officers are. You know, where the staff NCOs are. I mean, this is where you've got to make sure that this person's sense of right and wrong, everything he's been taught, just because he's in this horrific, traumatic environment, you know, he can't lose that moral compass. And you've got to make sure that you keep reassuring that everything he believes in, everything he was brought up in believing in, is still right. And despite the horrors of what he's seeing, he's got to be able to keep on that track, you know, to make sure that he believes that the leadership understands and is with him in this in some way.
So what do you say to somebody who's going to follow in that lieutenant's footsteps, and he's going to, his moral authority, as you said, is going to be immediately challenged by, hey, this is combat, we don't do it like that here. And then, you know, and I would tell you, I mean, how many different officers or leaders do you think saw those pictures, saw scalps, and either laughed or looked the other way, or you know, they didn't want to have that confrontation there. So what do you say to young leaders when they get what do they do when confronted with, that's not the way we do it in combat?
Well, what you've got to do is you've got to trust in your training, you've got to trust in your belief system, you've got to trust in your sense of what's right and wrong, and you're the one that's supposed to stand for all that. And, you know, you and the staff and NCOs. And one of the problems we had in Vietnam was, you know, we made officers out of the experienced and quality staff NCOs. So we raped the ranks of the staff NCOs, moved them up as temporary officers, and then compounded the problem in that we had quickie promotions. You know, you arrived in Vietnam and you could go from PFC or Lance Corporal to Corporal and Sergeant in a hurry. And there was no NCO Academy or anything else. And so we ended up with a large number of staff NCOs and NCOs that had moved up too quickly, did not have the benefit of not experience, but also the academies and the education and that sort of thing too. So a lot was falling to the lieutenants and the captains, and you know, when you looked at some of the things that happened over there, you know, whether it's the My Lais or some of the, and we all know the stories out there, you know, the officers, it fell to them to make sure this stuff didn't happen. You know, you're talking about 17, 18, 19-year-old young men that got thrown into something that is so horrific. I've been doing a lot of reading and about Pacific and World War II. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the enemy there, the atrocities committed by the enemy. You know, when the Marines first saw that, you know, prisoners that were surrendering weren't really going to surrender, they were going to pull out a grenade, blow themselves up. They saw the way POWs were treated and everything. I mean, their whole sense of right and wrong got challenged. And there was a time I remember reading where the senior leadership in the Marine Corps, they were getting requests to say, we should not take prisoners. We should just shoot them because it's too dangerous. And there was a debate about this because we had so many incidents that like this had happened. But they wouldn't come down and say, shoot all prisoners. They said, you know, we have to be extra careful. We have to be aware of this. We have to do this. But we aren't going to go to the point where saying we condone shooting prisoners. Now, did prisoners get shot? Sure. You know, obviously we know that. But there was not going to be an official condoning of this sort of thing. And so in all conflict, in all war, you're going to find these sorts of problems, you know, where the moral and ethical and even legal parts of what you should and could do get fuzzy or get confusing. And you're asking people with no experience in this sort of thing to try to hold the ground in terms of what right or wrong is. And they need reassurance. They need support. They need to know that just because you're in this environment, that doesn't mean that you're sort of waiving all these things, or there's sort of a way that your belief system and your values and your quotes don't apply. You can't do that. I know when we went to enhanced interrogation techniques and all that stuff, we really muddied the waters. I mean, this is about who we are as opposed to who the other guy is. You can make all sorts of hypothetical cases as to, well, what would you do in this case? What would you do if this happened? Well, you know, my answer is don't compromise who you are. Don't compromise your values. Don't compromise your code. Don't compromise your belief systems. Because you'll spend the rest of your life just regretting what you did. And that's going to be hard to tell your kids about that.
Well, you know, sir, I do a thing called post-traumatic winning that talks about, you know, living with, you know, with traumatic events in your life. And one of the things I talk about is we don't teach keep your honor clean very well. You know, you don't keep your honor clean for the Marine Corps. You keep your honor clean for you because you've got to put your head on your pillow for the rest of your life. And if either through your negligence, your laziness, or your own stupidity, right, all of which you're culpable for, somebody else gets killed, wounded, or maimed, nobody can lift that burden from you. Nobody can. You'll know the truth about whether it was your fault or not. And all the different things, whether you're on limbo with somebody or out doing operations and people want to take shortcuts. And God forbid something bad happens, because if it does and you don't do what you're supposed to do, you don't do what the song says, which is really odd. Do you think they knew, sir, all the way back then? Nobody knows who the hell wrote the song. So you can't ask them, but there was probably a lot of cool shit you could put in the song after First to Fight for Right and Freedom. And to blow their ass away. I mean, you can put some cool stuff in there, but we put it, and to keep your honor clean. Nobody else has a lyric like that. And so, I find it very interesting, and I don't know that we teach it well enough.
Well, push it forward to the early 90s when the trend came for organizations to establish their core values. And, you know, we said, you know, honor, courage, and commitment. Actually, at the time when we were going through which what they would be, I wanted honor, courage, and discipline. But commitment came in there, because I thought your core values, when you hear those core values, they immediately should come to mind, United States Marine. And obviously honor and courage say that. And I thought discipline says it better than commitment. You know, commitment sounded like a 90s, you know, relationship term or whatever. But when you look at a Marine and you hear honor, courage, commitment, you relate it right away. And to me, if we believe in that, if that is a core value, and set of values, then you got to live it. You can't say it's just something we put out and has no meaning once you march onto a battlefield. You know, and you can't be intimidated by those that say, well, you're naive. You know, so I've been in plenty of firefights, and I had 3 bullets that went in through me, and one's still there. And, you know, so I don't want to hear it. You know, it doesn't make you more macho. It doesn't make you a better guy. And, you know, your C stories don't justify violating your core values.
Interesting. What's when you look at the discipline of the unit, what's the role of the officer? What's the role of the staff non-commissioned officer and the NCO? Do they all have the same role? Do their roles differ?
No. They have very different roles, and I think one of the things that happened to us after Vietnam, because like I said before, the NCO and Staff NCO Corps, we had really abused on that war for a lot of different reasons. We were finding lieutenants and officers trying to do the role of the Staff NCO and the NCO, and that doesn't work. We, of course, got that back when we went through the professional development of NCOs and Staff NCOs and the development of the academies and the courses, and we went through the standards that we had set for promotion, and obviously recruited the all-volunteer military force at a higher level. Initially, we got back those kinds of NCOs and staff NCOs that I saw when we first came in that were the World War II Korea guys, you know, the backbone of the Corps. I know you know I put out, when I was a regimental commander, a letter to all my officers and staff NCOs and NCOs what the roles were, to spell it out carefully. And in my mind, I go back to what Staff Sergeant Ball told me in my first platoon. His job was to make each and every individual Marine who met the standards needed to achieve the unit and organizational goals. My job was to set those standards and goals for the unit. So my job was to understand how to fight that platoon, how to make sure that platoon lived up to everything it was supposed to be. His job was to make sure he and the other NCOs, to make sure each individual filled his role and lived up to it and could do it. So he had to make sure the parts were in place. I had to make sure the whole was functioning and doing what it needed to do and had the standards set for us to achieve our missions.
Was that the biggest challenge in retrospect, coming out of Vietnam? Was you know, Colonel Wes Fox, he's one of those guys who you were talking about. He was a gunny. He was a first sergeant select, and Colonel Barnum tells the funniest story about calling up the new CO of Alpha 19 because he heard some grenades going off down the hill around his fire base. He'd never met him, but he called him up to his tent to chew his ass, and in walks the real life John Wayne. You know, right? And said, if you wanted to order a Marine from Central Casting, you order Wes Fox. And Colonel Barnum tells a funny, like, he walks in and he looks at him and goes, "Who the hell are you?"
Yeah.
"I'm Lieutenant Fox, sir." "What the hell's going on down that hill, Lieutenant Fox?" "Oh, wait." And he tells this funny story about, you know, we don't get any fresh water down there, so my guys go to bathe, we get water, and then we throw a couple grenades in the stream, and then we harvest the fish, and they have some protein. And he said, "Well, shit, don't be afraid to tell people what you're doing down there." And it started, obviously, a lifetime friendship. But coming out of Vietnam and all the stories that, you know, General Van Riper has talked about on doing these interviews, General Mattis has talked about, was it the decimation of the staff NCOs? I want to say there was almost 5,000 staff NCOs taken out of the staff NCO Corps. What do you remember about discipline in that period time in the Marine Corps?
Well, you have to remember what was happening at that time. I mean, we had racial unrest, the drug culture was flourishing, we were inflicted with programs like Project 100,000. We were taking 100,000 of the lowest mental category, you know, another McNamara brain fart, you know, and so there were quality issues. I went through what was happening to the NCOs and staff NCOs. You know, we we were making the highest quality officers. They were moving up the ranks too quickly because we needed to expand and fill so quickly. And when we came out of Vietnam and we looked back at all this, and we said, we've got to change, you know, we've got to transform. And then the ideas started to come out that what impressed me was the thinking was bold. We're going to go to an all-volunteer military. First thing we heard is screams, you'll never man an all-volunteer military. You have to have the draft. You need the draft. And then we said, no, we think we can do it. And then the second thing we said is there's going to be a set of standards, high school diploma, you know, clean drugs, no drugs. We're going to, you know, demand a certain mental category, a certain fitness and physical conditioning requirement. And everybody said, you can't do that, you can't do it. And then we said, we're going to revamp the military education system. You know, we are going to educate at every level. We're going to put a tremendous amount of investment into NCO education, staff NCO education, even officer education. We're going to value education like we did before. If you're busting your butt at night and getting a degree, that's going to count for something. So, you know, and then, you know, we had people like General Gray and others talking about, you know, you've got to develop that brain as well as the other muscles. Then we started to relook at our entire philosophy and the way we fought. So then, you know, and of course, this generated the whole maneuver warfare movement and the debates through the mid late 80s. And we have to move away from attrition warfare, dependence on technology. We got to approach the operational arc with a different mindset. You know, we got to value our thinkers more. We've got to put more emphasis on conceptualizing. You know, the Quantico changed from being a requirements-based system, you know, based on doctrine. They changed it to, you know, it's going to be based on concepts and concept development. But the other services were doing the same thing, you know. And we did the biggest thing I thought that doesn't get much attention is accountability. You know, with the MSTP, BCTP in the Army, the first time I went to look at the Army's BCTP program, it was down at Fort Bragg, and it was 18th Airborne Corps.
Hey, so just tell everybody what that acronym stands for.
Well, it's a battle concept. You know, it's testing people on their tactics and operational capability, and it basically seeing if you know your shit, you know, and war fighting. And the decision was made starting with the Army, and then all services followed. This will go from the Corps level on down. This is not just going to be testing, you know, companies and platoons. And the first thing that came out was there's no whining. We're going to empower the evaluators on this thing to really put it to you. And, you know, you're going to, whether you're a three-star general or a lieutenant, you're going to stand there and listen and take it on board. So when I went down to see the first one of these, I was at headquarters Marine Corps, and I got sent down to look at this. And it was General Luck, Army three-star at that time, later on four-star commander, Korean Forces. And he was regarded as one of the, you know, most brilliant operational officers in the Army. And this group of evaluators, colonels, got up and just hammered him. I mean, hammered the Corps and all this stuff. And I thought, holy cow, it's a three-star general, and he's got division commanders there, two stars. I said, they're going to come back and eat these colonels lunch and lieutenant colonels. And I watched General Luck saying, you know, You're absolutely right. That is all good stuff. That is a superb critique. And I want to go through every one of those and show you, you know, how we didn't, you know, what we did wrong here, what we did wrong there, what we should have done here. And I'm listening to this and I'm thinking, I can't believe it. You know what it took me back to when I was a CG's aide in 2nd Marine Division? The general at the time was General Haynes. And he told me when he selected me as his aide, he said, I want you to be my operational aide. He said, let the, at that time he had a lieutenant as an aide too, he said, let the lieutenant handle the social stuff and all that stuff.
Yes. That's Fred Haynes?
Fred Haynes, yeah.
Wow.
And he said, He said, I picked you for a certain reason. He says, you're an AWS grad. You had command of a company in combat. You had command of a company in 2nd Marine Division. He had this big list. He said, when we go out to the field, he said, after we watch whatever we see in the field or we go out to an exercise, I want you to sit down with me and tell me what you saw. And I want you to be honest with me. And, you know, so we did this, and I gave him my feedback. And one day, I would just, we'd go out to these battalions, and it was clear to me we were seeing people that did have, you know, at battalion commander level, regimental commander level, you know, did not know what the hell they were doing. And I finally said out of frustration to him one day, sir, I said, these guys are horrible. I mean, it's like they never had a tactics course. You know? And he turned to me and he said, have you ever heard of a battalion commander or a regimental commander getting relieved of duty for being incompetent in terms of his tactical ability or operational ability? And I said, no, sir. He says, you ever hear one get relieved for administrative reasons or personal conduct? And I said, yes. And he said, well, see, there's our problem. You know, and so I remembered that. And now I was seeing where you were going to get held accountable. You know? And of course, in the Marine Corps, we developed the MSDP, the CATS program. I mean, when you went out and did these things, everybody knew how you did.
Right.
You know, and of course, the MSDP guys gave you the evaluation. So, I mean, you couldn't hide your shit. It's out there for everybody to see. And so you, no one could fake it anymore. And I thought that, going back to, this is all part of the transformation in the post-Vietnam era. And I think, you know, obviously, we lost, I think, I probably was one of the last Vietnam guys in the senior leadership role. But I think afterwards we began to just see a few officers that caught the end of the war, maybe, as a platoon commander,
right,
in four-star ranks. But then, you know, basically, Iraq and Afghanistan, the senior leadership, the Vietnam experience was gone.
Right.
And the Vietnam experience burned stuff into our souls that we didn't have there anymore.
The I want to read a section of your letter, the letter that you wrote about the staff non-commissioned officer. The let me ask you, in public, do you still have, I got a copy of this sent to me by somebody, do you still have copies of the one you wrote about the NCO and the officer?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
And I get asked for it every once in a while. My son, who's a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps, is actually out in Afghanistan now, and he sent me an email and said, hey, my sergeant major wants your letter to the staff and NCOs and officers in 9th Marines. I said, Jesus, I didn't realize that was still floating around, but I know the staff and NCO academy at Quantico and several other places that, you know, were using it, so... I couldn't believe that it's still alive.
All right. Well, I need to get a copy. But you wrote one about the role of officers and the role of the NCO as well?
Yeah. Well, it's one letter.
Okay.
And I did it. This had been bugging me for a while. I think as a hangover from everything we've talked about Vietnam, I was seeing lieutenants come out, and they were not giving their platoon sergeants kind of the ability to fulfill their role in the platoon. The lieutenants were trying to do everything.
Right.
You know, the Marine had an issue and a problem, boom, right away, it's the lieutenants. And I was seeing now that we had regained the quality of the NCOs and staff NCOs, and this would bother me. I mean, it was happening, and I wanted to find a way to get this sort of mutual respect, you know, what I saw and what I gained from my platoon sergeant. So I wrote the letter to all my officers and staff NCOs and NCOs, and I had a phenomenal sergeant major out in 9th Marines. He'd been wounded had nine Purple Hearts, so he was Sergeant Major Grochevsky.
Holy shit.
And I said, you know, I really want to instill this. And then I started running officer school 2 days a week, and I would pull the officers out away from their units for officer school, which ran a half day and into the night. And I started to hear the complaints, you know, sir, officer school's great, but, you know, we got to be with our units. And that's what you got platoon sergeants for, and that's what you got, you know, first sergeants and gunnies for. And I have one incident that I want to tell you about. I had this lieutenant come up to me after one of the officer schools, and he said, sir, he said, you know, it was a rotational battalion, so they had just come in. He says, sir, I like the officer school, don't get me wrong, but he said, I got to be with my platoon. I mean, you know, if I'm not down there, things aren't going to get done. And so I said, just bear with me, you know, Lieutenant. And he came back to me a couple weeks later, and he said, sir, I want to come back and say I was wrong. He said, you know, after I told you that, I went back down to my platoon area, and I was convinced that they would be scattered all over and nothing would have been done. He said, my platoon sergeant had held an inspection. He had run a course, you know, taught a class for all the units. They had cleaned the barracks. He goes through all these things. He did it all on his own. And so we had a staff NCO officer happy hour the next week. And this staff sergeant comes up to me, and he says, sir, I want to thank you for the officer school. And I said, you do? He said, yeah. He said, you got the lieutenants away from the platoons, and we got a chance to do our thing. And it's great. And he says, I have a fantastic lieutenant, and I love him. And he said, but, you know, he tried to do everything. And he said, I had a chance to show him what I could do, and this was really great. So I said, by chance, is your lieutenant, and I named it that lieutenant. He said, yes, sir, that was my lieutenant. And so, you know, I got with the officer there, so I called the lieutenant over, and we got into a conversation about all this. But, you know, that lieutenant didn't realize how good his platoon sergeant was. He needed the opportunity to see it, and the platoon sergeant needed the opportunity to prove it to him. So the letter meant something for him because we gave him that space. And, you know, from my sergeant major and the first sergeant, they were all saying, you know, this is great because not every platoon sergeant is going to take advantage of it, do it right, but, you know, he's getting the opportunity. And they were able, the senior staff NCOs, the first sergeants and the sergeant major, were able, because I had them run their staff NCO school and NCO school, and they were able to say, this is your chance. You know, the colonel's pulling the officers away for school, and this is your chance to show them what you can do. And obviously, they're going to help the new staff sergeants, too. You're going to have the gunnies and the first sergeants and the sergeants major and master sergeants and all working with them.
I have a question for you, and I want to read a part of your letter. It's about midway through the first paragraph. The value of the staff NCO for me has been the experience, knowledge, and example he brings to the unit. He has been there. He has successfully come up through the ranks. He knows how to best translate orders and directions into efficient and effective action by Marines. The traditional view of the staff NCO is the backbone of the Marine Corps is absolutely correct. The image of the Corps is embodied in the Daleys, Quicks, Bazelones, and other legendary staff NCOs of our past. These were men whose courage and expertise built confidence and esprit along the chain of command from above and below. They made things happen on the battlefield and in garrison. Staff NCOs enforce the standards, be it in combat or in peacetime. They are the conscience of the unit and the keeper of those high, tough standards that separate the Corps from other military organizations. I want to ask you two questions. The first is the whole concept that garrison is chicken shit, and the only thing that really counts is what goes on in combat.
That's dead wrong. You know, the old sort of Hollywood concept that, you know, you empty the brigs and there you got your fighters, that's all bullshit. You know, my experience, the NCOs, the staff NCOs, the ones I saw in garrison that shined in that environment were the same ones that shined on the battlefield. You know, there's no separation. The whole idea, I mean, go back to the point I made about you know, boot camp inspections and weapons inspections in Vietnam. I mean, there's a clean, as that lieutenant said, there's a clean weapon. There's no such thing as, you know, you clean it to a certain degree for Vietnam and another degree for garrison. I want to tell you about experience I had as a battalion commander. And it started when I was battalion XO in 1-8, then became battalion commander 2-8. General Toomey came down as the CG of 2nd Marine Division. And I don't know if you ever heard of General Toomey. Great big guy.
Yes, sir.
Really tough and gruff. They called him the gunny. And the first thing he did is he put out a set of standards. He said, every morning, every unit, the 2nd Marine Division, will do 1 hour of drill, followed by a formation and inspection. That any group of Marines, more than two or three going from point A to point B, will be marched. So he put all these standards out, you know, and all these requirements. And you should have heard the uproar. Oh, God, no, this is chicken shit. What are we doing? And all of a sudden, the whole atmosphere changed. I mean, when you walked around the 2nd Marine Division areas of Camp Lejeune, everybody looked squared away. Units were going from point A to point B, not in a gaggle, but in a formation. Every morning, people were drilling. As you went down the streets, you could hear the staff NCOs calling cadence. You could, and even the officers. When I was a company commander, we had drill competition in 2nd Marine Division, and I could remember all the formations in the drill, and that's something I had to be really learn to be good at. And I remember winning the regimental drill competition in when I was in company commander in 8th Marines. I mean, it was a pride and joy of our unit. And these sorts of things are important. I mean, these are the things that, you know, we fuzz the standards. When I was a battalion commander, we went to the rifle range. I told my sergeant major and all my company commanders, no Marine leaves his rifle range until he's qualified. You know, and so I said, I don't give a shit if he's going to be out there 2 years. He's going to qualify. And obviously we had some Marines that had to stay longer. But everybody in the battalion was qualified, you know, on his weapon. And I remember when I got this trophy from General Toomey, you know, 100% qualification. And I thought, what's the big deal? This is what you're supposed to do. I mean, why would you, you know, I remember in Vietnam when I did a company inspection looked at the weapons, I was going down the line and I'm looking at what the gear these people are carrying, these Marines are carrying, and who set the standard? Where's the SOP on what you carry? Who carries what in the squad in the unit? You know, in the way they were carrying things, and you know, there was no standardization. I got to one Marine who had a scope on his M16. I had never seen a scope on an M16, and I asked the Marine. I said, "Where'd you get? You know, are you a sniper?" You know, I was thinking, you know, "Do I have snipers in the company?" And he said, "No, sir." I said, "Well, what's a scope?" He said, "Sir, I drew the rifle. It was on it." And I said, "Just, you know, what did you qualify?" Because he came right from you know, boot camp ITR. I said, "What did you qualify as?" He said, "Sir, I was UNC." I said, "UNC? You know, first of all, what the hell are you doing with a scope? But what the hell are you doing here if you're UNC, you know?" And we actually had a rifle range. These Marines weren't qualified, or they were low marksmen. I wanted to upgrade there. I wanted to be able to shoot and hit what the hell was shooting at, you know? That's a minimal requirement I would take in combat. And I would look at what they were carrying, you know? The guys who carried the F-79s, the grenade launchers, you know, they had bags full of these grenades, which is dangerous to begin with. We have the best, you know, you got to put them on and carry them in a way that's safe. What's the ammunition? What's the standard load we're taking out? I mean, none of this had been established in the company, or if it ever been, it had washed away and people get lazy. When I told the company we're going to be training when we're back in base camp, you should have heard the uproar. You know, and I said, "No, we're going to train." I said, "Every NCO in this company is going to learn how to call in air and artillery and mortar fire." And I had my FOs, you know, that hold the classes. We're going to do drills, on and off helicopter drills. We're going to teach. I'm going to teach you courses in scouting and patrolling, and you know, and all of a sudden you saw this change. The sense of pride, the sense of knowing your shit. And when we go to field, we go on out in the field, you could tell. You could look around and see everybody was standardized. You know, if there were two flashlights in the squad, everybody knew who had the flashlights. And if somebody became a casualty, what that person may have been carried that, you know, not everybody was carrying, that we needed a squad to make sure you get it off them before you medevac them. I mean, SOPs and standards like that. And we let all that shit go to hell once we get into a combat environment. We just get lazy, we get sloppy, we get bad habits.
In my conversations with not only my sons, but other Marines that listen to this program. I've learned a lot. And my observation is that somehow or other, in this discussion about if what you say is true and valid about the staff and SEAL being the backbone, we have done something institutionally to our backbone, because the guys are just as good. They're the same people that have always come up through our ranks and excelled. My opinion is we've done something to their ability to do what they have historically done, which is be the foreman on a construction site, which happens all over this country. But in my opinion, it's important, their tone of voice. Now I can't say, hey, Glasses, or hey, Zinni, come here, bring your Ginzo ass over here. I have to say, hey, Lance Corporal Zinni, please come here. And if I don't say it the right way, you'll hear them say, you know, he's gonna go in the first sergeant and say that I hazed him in some way, shape, or form. And so, how does this thing work if we've created an environment in which our staff NCOs, and some people tell me this is bullshit, Mac, that's an excuse and it's a cop-out, but I don't believe that. I've seen enough my own self before I retired in 2015 that they don't have the tools that they used to have, and they used to call it playing fuck-fuck. Oh, really? You could get sent to the chow hall. You were going on working parties to the armory, right? Were you going to go dig a machine gun pit? I reported to the fleet in 1984. And I want to say there was an Almar that got published shortly before I got to the fleet, because they were bitching about it. And that was, if you assigned somebody EMI, you had to periodically go check on them during the course of the day. And they thought, this is such bullshit. Like, this is not the Marine Corps. Why do I got to go out and check on him if he's digging a fighting position? I go look at it when it's done. And obviously somebody was doing it out in 29 Palms or wherever and fainted and probably died or something or almost did and yada. How does the Marine Corps function if staff and COs aren't doing what they've historically done?
Well, you know, it goes back to a deeper problem in our society. We now raising generations that are not allowed to be exposed to any stress.
Right.
You go onto a college campus, which I was on one not too long ago, and they wanted to show me the safe room. At first, I thought it was a place you go in case there's a shooting or something.
Right.
But it was a place with whale sounds and, you know, easy chairs and, you know, if people get stressed, they have, you know, of course we know the story of the timeout cards.
Right.
And so we wonder why we have so many cases of people that the stresses of combat really affect them, heavily. If you're not allowed to expose people to stress, and now what should happen with that, it's not a matter of abusing them, it's putting them under stressful conditions and then teaching them and training them how to handle that stress. That's the point. If you can't do anything that is perceived as stressful, then what you're doing is you're going to allow them to be confused, because when they get in, the enemy, it doesn't give you timeout guards, you know? And when they get into those conditions, they aren't going to be able to cope with it, because there's been no preparation for it. There's been no, you know, you're trying to train somebody to go onto the football field that you've not allowed any blocking and tackling in practice. I mean, how could that be? They're going to get hurt. And not be able to cope with it. But it's societal. It's washed over from this. That's why we have helicopter moms now and parents. You got to be involved in every area. That's why every kid gets a trophy. Nobody's allowed to feel, oh my God, I didn't do as well as Johnny, or our team didn't do as well as the other team. That's life. You know, I mean, how do you deal with life? And we're wondering why we have all these problems of coping, why people resort to, and, you know, abuse drugs or, you know, find other ways to try to deal with the stresses of life, other than learning how to deal with it and cope with it. And I don't know how you do that unless you get exposed to it. Now, I'm the first one to tell you, I don't believe in abuse, and I don't believe in degradation of an individual in respect, but I think we know how to put stressful conditions on people and test their abilities without abuse. And the other part of that's respect for authority. You know, I mean, that platoon sergeant, you know, he isn't going to sit down with you and try to explain in detail and an order he gives in the middle of combat. I mean, it's going to be, you know, come on, you bastards, you want to live forever? You know, and you race across that wheat field at Bella Wood, and everybody's going to go. I mean, I listened to a video that was, there were a bunch of veterans from World War II. It's a little bit older video. And somebody was asking them, how were you able under the stresses of Iwo Jima and all this to do what you did? And they just said, you know, your training kicks in. You fall back on it. It's what you learn, you know. And when that sergeant tells you to go and do, and you just go and do, you know. But we're going to create a situation where you don't develop that. You don't develop it in training. Nothing can be hard for people. You know, we've created generations now that can't be stressed in any way, can't be seen as succeeding and failing. Yet, I don't know if you've ever read Teddy Roosevelt's speech at the Sorbonne, where he talked about the man in the arena.
Yes, sir, I have. Yeah, absolutely.
Everybody, every Marine ought to read that, because it's what counts is that you go into the arena. And Teddy Roosevelt says you're going to fail, you're going to fall down, you're going to get dirty, you're going to hurt. But the point is, you're going to get up, and you're going to keep doing. I mean, and if you don't put this individual in the arena, if you're trying to protect them from that, they're never, when they face that, be able to handle it or cope with it.
I want to, you're one of the leaders in the Marine Corps. That helped the Marine Corps understood it well at first, but the transition to a maneuver warfare style of fire. What's the role of discipline play in that system? And if you could launch that into a peer fight, and I believe the last peer we fought is the one you fought. I read the stories of the battles of Leatherneck Square, Contien, Dong Ha, Chulai, the fighting that went on up there around Camp Carroll, around Quezon, with the NBA. They were coming to put our heads on a stick. And, I mean, you read the story of Delta Company 1-4 getting overrun by the DMZ, that the NBA had flamethrowers. And you're like, holy shit. You know, Operation Prairie 1, I think 1,200 NVA soldiers killed in a two-week period, and I want to say 279 Marines killed. I mean, that's no shit combat. That's not like the ROE, you know, an ambush game that you know, that got played most of the time in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so I'm curious about your thoughts. Going to fight a peer, because you read the stories of you read of the field craft of the NVA are amazing. I interviewed a squad leader from India Company 3-9 that was in the same company that Butch Neal was in when Lieutenant Bobo was awarded his Medal of Honor. They had 4 Navy Crosses, 6 Silver Stars, 3 Bronze Stars at the Battle of Gettysburg Quarter. And the NVA tracked him all day. And then when they got told to set in 3 platoon ambushes and the company commander pushed back, he got told to shut up and color. And when each platoon got a click away from the company CP, the NVA walked mortars across it, and they tried to overrun them. That's the state of the field craft of a peer, even though he didn't have, you know, the supporting arms and the aviation assets that we had, although he had artillery and mortars. How do you do peer warfare if you're not disciplined organization?
Well, you're not. I mean, and you know, you began this with about the maneuver warfare. One of the tenets of maneuver warfare is trust. You know, and obviously, if you can't have trust, then you're not going to be able to. And it's backed up by training and education and discipline. But let me give you an example of what I mean by that. You know, if you look at the rules of engagement, and my son was a weapons company commander in 1-6 when they took Margin. And he, you know, he's trained to run a fire support coordination center. You had clear fires 2 levels above him. How does that demonstration of trust? You know, our doctrine and what we train people to do, you know, he's been through a CACS, he's been through fire support coordination courses in schools. He's done it. And so we don't trust a battalion fire support coordination center to make decisions. It's got to go 2 levels above. you know, it doesn't make any sense. That's a lack of trust, and it violates one of the principles of the whole Renaissance in the operational art, where we're going to develop junior leaders and trust, and not be able to operate on intent and believe in what the training and education we give them the ability to do. Then we take it away from them. You know, so, you know, where's the faith and where's the trust in that? And, you know, if you're going to put them through that training and going to tell them that's what their obligation is, which we've done all throughout our history, then suddenly say, you're not capable of that, Captain, anymore, or Lieutenant Colonel or Major. You know, I mean, it doesn't make sense. I think the quality of the people we have today is there. It's the disbelief by those that don't understand what you face in combat as to what you've got to be able to do. I'm reading a book right now on 1st Marine Division at Joseon Reservoir. I mean, it is unbelievable what they did. And without discipline, any unit would have fallen apart under those circumstances. How it didn't is a testimony to the Marine leadership and discipline, you know, from O.P. Smith down to those regimental commanders, Chesty Bullard and the others, and what they went through. And you can see when you read all that, and you can just see that the only thing left was all your training and education. It's freezing cold. You're being overrun by hundreds of thousands of Chinese. They're all around you. They're relentlessly attacking you. What do you fall back on? There's no timeout card. There's no one trying to relieve your stress. You got to stand up and do it. Marines wounded 3, 4, 5 times, still fighting. You know, and caring about their people. Coming out with all their equipment, coming out with all their people. It just shows you the proof again of what discipline can do, and self-discipline. And, you know, we used to say Marine Corps builds men. I mean, and now men and women. But the idea is we're building that into you, your ability to withstand that. You know, the stress of the combat, I can tell you from someone who's been chopped to pieces laying on a battlefield, a lot of things go through your head that you got to push out. It's the discipline of saying, you know, do I worry about me? Do I worry about my family? Do I worry about my Marines? Well, my job right now is worry about my Marines. You know, and you got to keep your head in the game, and you got to do it. Not knowing whether you're bleeding to death or not, and the corpsman doesn't know, where do you go? What do you do? I mean, there's something that has to kick in, and that has to do with what you feel, you know, your responsibility is, your duty is, and that requires a lot of self-discipline to stay tuned in.
I was at the Air Force Academy yesterday speaking about this thing that I call post-traumatic wing, and it's built around something my company, Gunny, told me when a Huey crashed inside my assembly area at 29 Palms when I was a company commander. The pilot was decapitated, co-pilot crushed to death. We tried to save the crew chief, a sergeant by the name of Bazarini, and a corporal who just went for a ride that day. And I say it was the first time I really participated in the dance of death, where you're trying as hard as you can to save somebody, and they're trying as hard as they can to live. And it's not like John Wayne in the Sands of Iwo Jima, right? Your hands are on them, right? You see the scared look in their face. I'll never forget Sergeant Bazzarini's jugular vein jumping out of his throat. And late in the day, my gunny walked up to me and he said, "How are you doing, sir?" And I said, "You know, I've been busy. I haven't really thought about it." And he then gave me the best advice I think I've ever been given in my life. And he looked at me and he said, "You know you're never going to get over this, right?" And I cussed at him a whole bunch and told him to get away from me. And then I asked him, "Who told you that?" And he just stood there, you know, 6'4", big ear, gunny. And he said, "You need to know that." And I said, "Who told you that?" And he said, "Vietnam guys told me that." And I didn't hear the whole story until last December when I had lunch with him 25 years later. And I said, "Hey, man, that advice has been huge in my life." And now I go and I talk to people about how you live a great life with trauma. And I talk, part of it's military stuff. My sister's two sons were murdered. And so I talk about, look, it's, I'm these lessons that come out of our culture that can transform people, can transform not only people inside the military, but civilians. It's because it's, they're universal truths. I said, where did you get it? And he told me a story about, standing next to his first sergeant as watching a master sergeant who was a Vietnam guy. In the late 90s, now in Recon Company, 3rd Recon Battalion, and he said he'd go get a 12-pack of Miller Tall's and go back to his room and get drunk every night, but show up for work the next day. And he said the first sergeant looked at him and said, you know you're never going to get over that, right? That kind of wisdom, that unvarnished, most of it coming down the enlisted side, not the genius side of the Marine Corps, but the smart side of the Marine Corps, long before there was any diagnosis of PTSD has now formed the core of something that I go around the country and talk about. I'll be in Kalamazoo next week, and so while I was talking, the Air Force wing commander at the end of my pitch stood up and he said, "You know, the things were that Mac's talking about." Are on the burner of the Marine of the Air Force. It's called intrusive leadership. Now I'm curious about your thoughts on that. The Air Force is even talking about intrusive leadership because we've backed so far away, and all in terms of suicide, all we get is more suicide. Spend more money, and everybody's numbers continue to go up. And I'm curious about what goes through your head when you hear a term like intrusive leadership.
Yeah, well, I don't even know what intrusive leadership is. I mean, I do know one thing, and this is the kind of thinking lately that theorists about leadership are talking about. When we talk about leadership, we tend to think about the old traditional heroic leadership. There's one guy, you know, one guy comes out in front. He's on the white horse. He's the tribal leader. He's the biggest, strongest. He's the charismatic guy. And that's leadership. Well, what we're finding is that's part of leadership. You know, obviously, you know, you're great commanders and all, but there's group leadership. If, you know, when a group comes together, when the culture is just right, when they bond, that's a form of leadership. You know, the idea of the core and the unit and your team, and if it's right and it bonds, and there's a function of leadership surely to help that happen, that's a leadership. You know, we haven't thought about groups as leaders, and leadership emerging from a group. And I think Marine Corps is a great example of that. Like I told you, just Chosan Bedwar, no Marine is going to let down the group or the team. And they're going to step up if necessary. So part of leadership is creating that culture. It's creating the culture to say, if I go down, next man up. And the group, you know, gathers around that. There's a couple of things that make a big difference between what I grew up in the Marine Corps with and what I saw change over time and where we are now. I remember when we were going to go to rooms for the troops.
Right.
And I was General Haynes' aide. I was in a car with General Barrow. General Haynes and General Barrow were in the back seat.
Holy shit.
And General Barrow said, if we go to this idea of rooms, it's going to destroy the Marine Corps. Now, this is General Barrow. You know, he's a commandant of the Marine Corps. He was, you know, bigger than life. He's a great hero of our Corps. He said, we're going to lose the camaraderie and the tightness, the ability to lean on somebody else, the ability of our NCOs and others to see when something is not going quite right, to intervene. And maybe that's the intrusive leadership. We put blocks to it, the intrusive leadership. You know, I'm all for it. I think it's great that the troops have their own room now. We've come to all this. But did we break down unit cohesion? Now we pay a hell of a lot. As a lieutenant, I barely made it payday to payday with uniform and car payments, you know. And so where did I go? I went to the club. That's where everybody went. You went to happy hour. You bonded there. Do we do that anymore? How many of our officers live off base? I remember in 1988, when General Gray came out to, CEO of 9th Marines, and he came out to watch an amphibious landing we were doing, and we were standing on the beach. And General Gray turned to me and he said, "This is an historic day in the Corps." And I'm trying to think, what the hell? I'm trying to remember the Iwo Jima, you know, Guadalcanal, what the hell? And I looked at him, he says, "Today we crossed the line. We have more dependents than we have Marines. And now it's exponentially more." I remember in one meth, because like I told you, my first platoon, there was only two married guys. My guy, a sergeant, and my platoon sergeant. Now, when in one meth, I looked at the platoons to get the number married, 43, and this is now back in the 90s, 43% in the platoons were married. You know, so now, this is all good stuff. I'm not criticizing Marines getting married or Marines having rooms, but you got to understand the impact. You know, when my platoon and my squad, they were all in there. They knew each other. They knew each other personally. They knew if Lance Corporal Jones is acting a little funny and a little strange and something's going on in his life. And, you know, the fire team leaders, the corporals I had then, you know, they could help Marines with personal problems. It didn't have to be the officer and the company commander. And they were this intrusive leadership. You didn't have to intrude. You were already there within the organization. I read something where the Royal Marines, when they came out of, when the units rotated out of Afghanistan, they didn't go directly back home. They went, I think to Cyprus or someplace, and they stayed together for a bit of time, a week or two, whatever, to decompress, to talk to each other about what they experienced, to look at each other, to see how everybody was handling it. You know, when I went out to do the assessments in Iraq and Afghanistan, what struck me is I would get on a plane, and literally 24 hours later, I could be in my kitchen. So I'm thinking about these Marines and soldiers that they're on a battlefield, and within hours, you know, at least a few days, they're thrown back into, you know, everything's back, you know, back home. You're back in the, you know, the fireplace and the warm, you know, the kittens and the kids. In World War II, you had to come back on those troop ships. You spent a lot of time together,
right. Decompressing,
thinking, talking, you know. So I would go to that word intrusive leadership. Tells me that you feel there's a need to find a way to intrude because it doesn't exist within the context of the system we have now.
That's a scary thought that now we have to look at. Hey, it's got to be intrusive because we back so far out of this thing. And as you said, I mean, it seeped from our public schools into the DOD. And now we're finding a way that we've got to get back into that business of hands-on leadership. And when I say hands-on, I don't mean physical leadership, but I mean you have to know them and love them and care about them.
It's harder. It's harder now. It's harder than I had it. Look, I commanded six companies, actually six and a half. I had a cadre company, too, as an additional duty while I was a company commander. You know, and I'm trying to think of four platoons, six companies. I mean, that's really rubber meets the road leadership are down there. But I got to tell you, I had it in an era where I was living with my troops. You know, I mean, basically, you're 24/7 in their life, or pretty close to it, and certainly my NCOs were. There wasn't something going on with one Marine that you didn't know about or didn't sense. It's a different world now, and I'm not making qualitative judgments
right.
on it, but it's harder now. You've got to lead in very different ways. You know, every Friday, I was in happy hour, and I was in the officers' club with all, and sometimes the staff NCOs would have officer night at the staff NCO club, and I'm in there with them, and, you know, we bonded. We knew each other. I didn't go off base very much, because what was there off base for me to do? First of all, I didn't have money to spend out there or anything else, but I didn't live off base. And now if you're married, you can sort of live off base. People encourage, they buy houses and all that. I see that, and God bless them. Don't get me wrong again. But again, it's not the same kind of group tightness and cohesion that's built from this, you know, being in this situation 24/7. Actually, that's one of the reasons why I chose to go to Okinawa. I had a chance to go down to to Tumef to be a MU commander, or to Okinawa to be a regimental commander. And one of the reasons I wanted to get the regimental experience, especially Okinawa, is they're deployed over there. They're 24/7 together. You know, they're living in the squad bays in that environment, the rotational battalions. They're trained up. They're at the peak of their qualifications and their ability when they're out there. And the amazing thing is it was almost like back to what I had seen when I first came in.
So talk about, if you wouldn't mind, if the lay of the land has changed that much, then it's incumbent on the leaders to in some way, shape, or form recreate those events to create the camaraderie, right? And you've got to recreate them. And I want to dovetail that to this. If I told you that a company in the Marine Corps was holding, a rifle company was only holding two formations a week, they were passing information via text messages and letting the platoons do their own thing, which even takes them, now we're not only out of the squad bay, but now we don't even have to interact with the company gunning but a couple times a week. And we're out of the evil eye of that E7 that is wire brushing everybody from his junior staff NCOs to the individual Marines. Can you do it like that?
You know, every organization has a key level or entity in it. You know, and I would argue that it's always been in the Marine Corps, the battalion. That's the, as we say in our doctrine, the smallest unit capable of independent operations. But if you look for a persona for a Marine unit, it's usually tagged on the battalion. You know, battalions have mottos, battalions have nicknames, you know, battalions are the lowest level with the staff that you're able to, in functional areas to do all this. And if you don't create a battalion identity, we deploy as battalions, as BLPs, rotational battalions and all that, and same thing for squadrons too. And so you need to create that sense of personal leadership, involvement, engagement, at that level, more than any other level. If you're passing it down to company or platoon, now they have to have that maybe even more intense relationship, but it is a battalion squadron context. And that's how you identify, that's where you identify most with, that point. And if we're not engaging at that level, if that battalion commander is not known by every Marine, and he doesn't know every Marine, he's not engaged with them, then you're compounding this problem. You're passing it to too low a level to engage, and I think in the end that's going to hurt you in the way you interact and the way you engage with your Marines, because probably at that battalion level, that's the lowest where you have an ability to engage with everybody on a person-to-person basis. Right. When you cut out the personal context, if you're going to go to technology and information communication technology as your means of communicating, you've lost the personal touch that's critical. From battalion, company, platoon level, squad, I mean, that has to be there. It's much harder at a regimental level. You really have to work at it, believe me. To say that every man in my regiment, every Marine in my regiment knows who I am and knows how I think or whatever, it's very difficult. You could certainly do it to the officers and staff and COs. It gets harder below that. At a division level, you know, obviously it's almost impossible. At that battalion level, if you pass that off to the companies and platoons, you're breaking down the key central element of within a larger organization that is necessary to maintain that sort of connectivity and cohesion.
You know General Ben Riper. You're good friends with him. He took a lot of grief when he published his 21 rules in right around 1990-ish when he was at the 2nd Division. General Farnesis did the same. In General Ben Riper's interview, he lays out just the most, this is why we did that stuff. But the Marine Corps didn't respond well back in 1990 to General Van Riper. You know, he was ridiculed. It's like, oh my God, you go down to Camp Lejeune and guys are going crazy about standing lights. People are throwing trash in each other's areas. You even made a joke about that, in your PME. And why do you think we forget these basic lessons and that we as Marines, if we're not disciplined, you know, that's our skeleton. That's our infrastructure. Why do you think? And it was interesting to watch the backlash against General Furness, and now it could even be greater because you know we all have social media and everybody gets an anonymous name and you know and can tell a general off. What do you make of all that? Why does this whole discipline thing seem to be at times in our history? Is it just the ebb and flow, the cycle of the way the Marine Corps goes?
I think it's right now there's a society that's much freer, and generations that are being created with, like we said, like we've been discussing, where no stress can be put on them, no discipline can be demanded of them, standards are very much loosened, you can't offend anybody. I just read something on the internet before I talk to you about San Francisco has just passed a law. You cannot refer to someone as a convicted felon anymore. It has to be somebody who was justice involved. So you have you can see where society is going. The military is a reflection of society. You're not going to, you know, we tried our hardest to immune ourselves from the racial and drug cultures that were happening in the 60s and 70s, and we could. I mean, there was a certain amount we could do, but you certainly couldn't, you know, live in a sealed off world from what was on the outside and what came in. And so what we're seeing now is a change in our culture. You want, let me go back to what you said about if we got involved in another peer war.
Right.
If you look at Russians and Chinese and you look at discipline and being hard and tough and having to grow up with stress and being able to endure it, how is the average American going to stand up to that? Right now, we know that 73-74% of the people eligible by age group to come into the military can't qualify. And that's shrinking every year. So whether it's drug use, abuse, or obesity, or whatever it is, you know, failure to complete school, whatever, where are we going to get the people that come off and out of the, that in World War II came out of the factories and off the farms and every place else that, you know, had something in them that they could bring because they've been through the stresses and hardships and all. We going to see that in this generation? I mean, I don't know. That's a good question. That NVA soldier that I saw, he was a tough nut. I mean, and he could endure a hell of a lot. And it was tough enough under that environment. And again, we were fighting that culture with the culture we had that had some major issues and problems. But that might even be worse now.
You've been very generous, so I've got two more questions, and I'll let you go. One is General Mattis published his flat-ass rules. General Van Riper published his 21 rules, and I think he wrote a couple of different documents. One is, I think, Advice for Subordinates is another great one, and I have them on my website. And General Furness just posted his, I think, daily basic routine or whatnot. You did a PME called Combat Concepts. I'm curious about articulating your vision, whether it's in 21 rules, whether it's Combat Concepts, because I will tell you what, sir, I've never seen anybody else do that. The first person I know that did it was General Furness, who went around with his roadshow and his slides. We've evolved since your overhead projector shit. But I thought, you know, I walked out of there, and I never met you in my life, but I had an idea of how you thought. Talk to me about the significance of whether it's 21 rules and advice, whether it's flat-ass rules, whether it's, you know, a daily basic routine or your combat concepts. How important do you think it is for commanders to get out there and no shit articulate what they expect from their organization in very, very, you know, very, very direct terms? How important is that?
You know, my approach is a little different. And I have no problem with somebody setting rules or setting standards. I think, you know, that's all great and needs to be done. People need to know what your expectations are. But I viewed it a little bit differently. It's not just me telling you what I expect of you. It's me standing up in front of you and showing you how I think, who I am. I need you to trust me, not me saying you need to do this so I can trust you. So the combat concepts was kind of, you know, at that same time we were talking about commander's philosophy. Remember, we were telling commanders now you should write down your command philosophy. You should update it every year. You should put it out as you learn and develop an experience. And I'm saying if we're doing that about leadership, why aren't we doing that about our profession of arms? So the combat concepts wasn't me saying, here's my 21 rules on how we're going to fight. Because that's a one-way, you know, dictate. I wanted to say, this is how I'm thinking about how, you know, we would fight. These are my thoughts. These are the things I'm convinced of. These are the things I'm uncertain about. And join me in this. Let's think about these things together. First of all, I think, you know, what I used to start that class out when I gave it in Ninth Marines is I said, one of the purposes of this officer school and the one we do twice a week is that some lieutenant in this regiment is going to find himself on a hill someday in the middle of combat, no communications, and he doesn't have a new mission. And he's going to say to himself, what would Colonel Zinni want me to do right now? And he's going to be able to answer that question. And I said, the purpose of these officer schools and me going through my thinking on combat concepts and everything is so you can get into my head. And we can go through this together. And it gives you an opportunity to question me and to challenge me. When you issue rules, you're not given that invitation. You're saying, here's the way it is, live with it, this is what I know is right, and you've got to do it. What I'm saying is, let's figure this out together. Let me tell you how I'm thinking. Let me tell you things I'm pretty sure of. You know, let's get a Vulcan mind meld here. So it's a little bit different approach than the issuance of rules and standards.
But their blowback would be, oh, well, wait a minute, Zinni, I did that too. So don't try to clip me on my rules just because you didn't write them. I can already, and so I guess rules are fine as long as you get out there and you fill in the blanks with your narrative of combat concepts. But let me tell you
something about rules. You put out the rule and this is the way it is. Something's going to happen that's an exception to the rule. And you're going to suddenly try to figure out, oh shit, you know, I've committed to this ahead of time. It's not dependent on context or situation. My idea is I want to teach you principles. I want you to live by these principles. I don't want to give you specific prescriptive rules. I mean, as a matter of fact, if you think about maneuver warfare, that flies in the face of maneuver warfare. You know, the idea that there are going to be rules, there's going to be principles of war, there's going to be these sorts of things. So, you know, one principle of war is the principle of mass, and you should never split your forces. I can give you 21 different scenarios off the top of my head where you might split your forces, you know. So, I remember a staff NCO coming up to me one time and saying, sir, what's your policy on this, and what's your policy on that? And I said, my policy is not to have a policy. You know, you will see by example, you will see by what we talk about how we should be behaving and conducting ourselves. Now, if it's necessary to have a list of prescriptive rules on how you should live your life and be a Marine, we got a problem. You know? I mean, if you think by I put out a rule and say don't drive fast, that means no one's going to drive fast, right? And I have to put that rule up because it's like, oh my God, I didn't know a speed limit was meant that you can't exceed that. I mean, I don't need to say that. And if you get caught, you're going to get punished with it. Now, we can talk about why do we have that speed limit? Why is it that speed on in this particular road? Why are we doing that? What's the purpose of it? What's the danger of not adhering to it? You see, I don't know if I'm explaining this right, but what I'm trying to do is conceptually come at these things so we think about them and come to the same decisions to how we should behave rather than me dictating and ordering a set of behaviors.
No, I understand it. I have them in my head. I have Jim and Ben Riper's discussion in my head about, well, I went on to do that, right? And so it wasn't a one and off kind of thing when I published that stuff. And the guys who published that, they've got a little gray matter going on. And I would think, but I don't think enough people do it. I mean, think about that. I mean, even if you just say that, you know, that's off the top of my head, that's three guys in the space of 40 years. Right, and like I said, I've never seen anybody do a combat concept presentation like you did. I mean, that thing you did in Quantico lasted what, 2.5-3 hours?
Yeah.
And that was you all leadership, comm, fire support, you know, maneuver warfare. I mean, you talked about all of it, and I just think not enough people stand up there and articulate, you know, their thoughts, whether we be talking about leadership, and here's my list, here's the footnotes that go with it, here's the lecture on top of that, all right, give me your best shot. Not enough people do that, which is, to me, the essence of filling in those blanks and getting them to understand your vision. But I've been surprised, and I've thought about this all those years, because I that PME changed my life. And you know this, I made cassette tapes for every lieutenant that asked for them that went through IOC for about 2 years. I wore out one of the greatest Sansui dual tape decks in the world because of that PME. And I'll run into them today, and they can quote that thing, right? They can quote chapter and verse of combat concept from 1990. I just think it was so powerful for all of us. And not enough people do it. And that's, to me, when you combine these, you know, whether it's your rules or your philosophy or whatever, the way you make it come alive is the power of your personality and how you animate it. And I've never seen anybody do it as well as you did that night.
Well, I mean, I appreciate that. But, you know, it's a form, it's a philosophical difference in leadership. You know, if you believe decision-making and leadership is a participatory function where everybody has a role to play in it, then you maybe take the approach of the combat concepts. If you believe leadership is a top-down directive function, then you issue rules. And again, I'm not talking issuing rules, because I think, you know, that helps explain who you are and what you are and what you expect, and there's a lot of goodness to that. I've worked for a lot of guys that lived by a lot of rules. I was XO in a battalion. A battalion commander published a policy every day, you know, and was written and distributed. I mean, the bulletin boards were full of them. But you knew where he stood and what he wanted. There was no guessing. And he lived by those rules. So, you know, I understand. It's just a different philosophical approach to leadership. You know, when I said that everybody in this group is a leader, someday you may find yourself in that position. And everybody owns a piece of the unit. It's not just my unit. You know, I find it interesting how commanders refer to their units. If they refer to our battalion or my battalion, that tells me a lot. You know, I've listened to commanders say things like, this battalion. As soon as somebody refers to that like that, I know he is trying to back away from responsibility and disown responsibility and accountability for things. if I hear him saying, my battalion, my this, I did that, I'm saying his ego's too big, and this is a directive leader. When I hear our, we, then I'm listening to somebody who believes, maybe like I do, that it's participatory. It's engaged. All of us are engaged. All of us have an ownership responsibility and a leadership responsibility.
All right, here's my last question. This is the general question. What haven't,
it should be a general question.
What haven't I been smart enough to ask you about discipline, your thoughts on it, how it applies to Marines, how it applies to us as a, the Marine Corps as a culture, that you want to make sure that people understand?
Well, let me give you two short ones. One, we shouldn't think of discipline as punishment. That often gets the most sort of the interpretation or definition. Discipline is living up to a set of standards. It's self-control. You know, it has a lot of aspects to it. I really believe our core values should be honor, courage, discipline. That's who we are. I can never figure out when I first came into Marine Corps why they were measuring the distance from the end of my belt buckle to the tip of the belt in fractions. And then I realized, because that shows you how detailed and how much attention to detail we pay. It signifies our discipline and attention to those details, because it carries over to our mission and our role in combat. So that becomes critically important. The other point I would make is about something related to discipline that often isn't connected, and that's this issue of loyalty. We have too much displaced loyalty. We somehow, if we're in a unit where members in the unit do something wrong, we feel our strongest loyalty is to the unit, so we should never do anything about it, or own up to it, or tell somebody about it. And the mistake we're making is assuming that loyalty exists just because you join a unit or you have a senior and you're responsible for giving loyalty, and that's the end of it. It's not. Loyalty is earned. You want my loyalty, give me your integrity. If you don't give me your integrity, you've lost my loyalty. I owe you nothing. That, we are overreacting on this loyalty issue. There's going to be a code of silence. We're not going to rat on anybody. We're not going to snitch, even though they're doing atrocious things which violate our code, our standards, our core values. If that person is doing it, he's lost your loyalty because he hasn't given you his or her integrity. And that applies to discipline too. You know, who do you give your loyalty to and under what circumstances? Cherish that loyalty. You don't give it. It has to be earned by somebody for you to be able to provide that loyalty. I want to make that point because I think it gets related to this.
Well, you know, so I'll tell you, disturbingly enough, there's been recent, you know, high-level general court-martials where, you know, people get immunity, then all of a sudden they change their story. They have a version that nobody's ever heard before. And then the people that, in my opinion, showed some moral courage and said, hey, look, we got told not to be afraid to report this kind of stuff. And we did. And what won in the end was never rat somebody out, never betray the group, you know, take care of your own.
Yeah.
And to me,
the question becomes who betrayed the group.
Well,
not the person that's reporting it, the person who violated a code or a standard or a value. That's where we're getting confused. And that's one of the things we have to do a better job in training and teaching and educating our people. You know, young people come in with this wrong code, you know, where, you can't snitch. There's gunfire in the neighborhood, kids are being killed, innocent people killed in the street, but you can't snitch on who the gangs are and who has the guns. So if that carries over, what you're saying is, I'm at fault for adhering and living to the standards and reporting the violations. You who violated it aren't as guilty as I am, even though you don't warrant that loyalty.
And again, you know, just an observation, and you can comment and I'll let you go, but, you know, we've seen the incidents in the 7th Fleet. a ship first night under new skipper out of port crossing a major shipping lane. Neither the CO nor the XO are on the bridge. You've got a relatively junior watch team with degraded radar going 22 knots through a shipping lane. And you hear that and you think, look, for all the, we didn't get enough sleep, not sure how that applies the first night out of port, and all these things that are so bad, there's a leadership solution to every one of those. Hey, let's back this thing down to 11 knots. If the radar is degraded, let's double the external watch. Right, we've been sailing around the world for a few hundred years. We can get through this thing tonight. But none of those things happen, and then we've seen just, I would say, the moral crisis in our special operation forces. We have Marines that have come in the Marine Corps and aren't even probably a year out of Eagle, Globe, and Anchor being thrust into their palm, crying during the Crucible when that happens, and now they're in the brig for smuggling. And so this, I think the societal problems, you know, have come into the military, and we're not sure how to handle them. We're not sure how much of that hands-on intrusive leadership has to still maintain, and how we can't be like the society. But in the meantime, you know, whether it's all these horrible trials that we're seeing coming out of the special forces community, whether it's human trafficking or ships colliding, literally killing people and destroying lives. And I think that's why this discipline discussion is so important, sir. And I want to thank you for sure. Give your thoughts and can't thank you enough for coming on and doing this.
Well, I appreciate being on. Thank you.
All right. That is General Anthony Zinni. Tony is his name, and he's been a repeated guest on All Marine Radio, and can't say thank you enough. All right, we're not going anywhere. It sounds like Van Riper and Zinni disagree, and so we're going to bring General Van Riper on right now, and we're going to ask him about that gap, what looks like to be a gap. And between General Zinni's I don't like lists, I think they're top down, and General Van Riper articulating things in throughout his career via lists. So, here we go. After hearing General Zinni, who I've been listening to since 1990 when I first crossed paths with him when I was a captain, and he was a colonel coming back from being the CO of 9th Marines, one of the things that went through my head when he was talking about how he thinks that publishing a list or something like that is top-down leadership was one of the things he said in his PME, and that's that he liked having different guys come on, and he liked the lieutenants and the captains that were sitting in the regimental PMEs at 9th Marines and everybody there to hear them disagree. And I think it promotes free thinking, and I think it also promotes a complete thought. And so joining me is Lieutenant General Paul Van Riper, and he's been arguing with Tony Zinni for a long, long time. So first of all, sir, appreciate you doing this.
My pleasure.
All right. Tell us about when did you first meet Tony Zinni?
We were both stationed at Camp Lejeune in the 70s, and I had reason to go to meet him, and I didn't know him before, but during the course of our time, short time together, and thereafter, I said, boy, he's junior to me at this time, but I'm learning a hell of a lot from this guy. So I made it a point from there on out, whenever I was with then Captain Zinni, I would keep my ears open and watch what he was doing and take as much as I could aboard. And I found throughout his career, my career, and even into retirement, I'm always learning. So whether we're out fishing together, whether we're having a debate and a beer together, Tony Zinni has a lot that is worthwhile, and I'm all ears when it comes to it. Now, having said that, we have a unique relationship in how we do things. I'll establish a point, he'll argue, we'll go back and forth, but occasionally things will switch back. We both did some consulting with the old Joint Forces Command, and we rode from our home here in Williamsburg down to Suffolk to the command. And on the way, we would start arguing about some point or other, operational ideas, some things about some strategic thought. And he would say, well, you know, Rip, you're all wrong in that, and here's why. And we'd go back and forth. So by the time we pulled into the parking lot, I said, Tony, you're right. I was misinformed on that. I'm in your corner now. Then we'd get into the command, and we'd be sitting there, and we'd pick up a similar argument, and he would flip on me. He'd pick up my argument and begin to develop that. So it was a great relationship, but we're always back and forth. And he has a knack of turning things around on you when you least expect it. So
So I'm sure you've heard this your whole life. This whole top down, dictating things. He makes a similar this argument where he says, I don't like fire support control measures. You know, you shouldn't have them. We don't need them. No terrain objectives. You know, a blank piece of acetate, right? Ninth Marine scheme of maneuver. That's a quote from him. He looked at his opso and said, now you get it. And I understand after listening and thinking what he's trying to promote, right, which is that horizontal communication that you have to have on the battlefield to make things go faster and to make things work. But ultimately, when you're a more mature thought is, yeah, but those things are essential, and if you need them, you begin to use them. And then he looks at you and says, exactly, McNamara, you're not as stupid as you look. So I want to ask you about this. You've been vilified in Marine Corps history often as, you know, the guy with the shaved head before shaving their heads is cool. You're a trendsetter, I might add. And you had these rules, and you were adamant about them. Then all of a sudden you come on All Marine Radio, and you begin to talk, you articulate your experience with Mike 3-7, your other experiences in your career, and all of a sudden doesn't look the same. And so I wanted to have you on before I published the General Zinner's interview and kind of tack this on to the end of it. What do you say to people that say, oh, yeah, that's top down, that's Van Riper getting down out the 8,000-foot screwdriver?
Well, General Zinner said he had no issue with my 21 rules. I have no issue with anything that he said in that interview. We're closer together than you might think. So let's take those 21 rules. They're not 21 rules. They're actually a discussion of a particular problem that I would observe. So if you look at it, and it's not just a rule, but there's an explanation of what it means. I've got a set in front of me. So here's this one's words of advice to subordinates. And I say, take a larger, wider view of what is good for the Marine Corps. And then I have a long paragraph there describing what I mean. The same for working in a positive mode. Don't advance on the troubles or problems of others. Be inquisitive. Assume nothing. Keep your eyes. Those are all part of that. In terms of the specific requirements in those so-called 21 rules, they were a result of problems I observed over a long career. They were systemic problems. They continue to happen. Particularly when you're in the era of some sort of conflict or war. So I never perceived them as lists in the sense that they locked you into something. They, in a sense, were the sort of conduct I expected, and here's what might get you in trouble if you don't follow them. The same with my philosophy of leadership. So I don't think General Zinni and I are that far off. Leadership is not a one-way street. It's a two-way street, and if you've got a command, it's obviously multiple relationships back and forth. I've always said there are three types of commanders. There's the one who walks in and says, ladies, gents, this is what we're going to do. He might say why, usually not. If somebody was bold enough to question him, he squashes him real quick. I didn't ask for that. I'll tell you what we're doing in this outfit. People generally keep their mouths closed. They're not real happy. And if the leader's competent, it'll be a pretty effective unit. If he's not, folks are trying to get out of this as quick as possible. How do I get out of this outfit, go someplace else, make a lateral move? There's the other leader that always welcomes debate, discussion, argument. The problem is he or she never comes to a resolution. So it's more like a fraternity bull session. It goes on and on and on. And in reality, that's the worst kind of unit to be in, because even if the commander makes a decision, tomorrow morning it's open for negotiations again. You want somebody that studies a problem, takes in all the input they can, makes a decision, and as long as the conditions hold, sticks to it. It's sort of the porridge is too hot and too cold. The real leader is the one who walks in, ladies and gentlemen, we've got this problem, we've got this issue. What do you think about it? And there'll be a free-willing discussion. It's never the rank of the individual that's contributing. It's the merit of the idea. And to the degree that you can support your side of the argument, and there's merit, the boss will probably take it aboard. He or she can do two things. One is they have enough information to make a decision, or they simply run out of time and they've got to make a decision based on what you've said. And I've emphasized this over and over. Decision is nothing more than storytelling. It's a commander or a commander with a staff telling themselves a story that makes sense. And it's that information that does it. People love to work with that kind of commander. That's General Mattis. That's General Zinni. Those are the kind of commanders that allow this free-willing debate, take all the information aboard, make a decision. Even the young captain whose view wasn't accepted, he had a fair shot. And so, in most cases, he'll be very supportive of the decision because he knows why the commander made it, because he was part of that long argument, debate, discussion.
And so, as you would articulate, when people ask you about your list, and I think General Furness would be of the same mind, that, look, I don't know that I would call this a list in terms of do this, some kind of rote, kind of didactic event. It is the initiation of the discussion that has taken us in that direction, because that's where we're going.
Right. I think one of the rules, they came from what, my number one, only the Marine, the sailor who owns a weapon will draw, clean, and return it to the armory. This includes everyone from division commander to the most junior private. Why did they make that rule? Because they took over 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines, and I see a Marine walking from the armory. He's got two rifles and a couple of pistols. And asked, well, sir, I drew the pistols for the staff NCOs and this rifle's for somebody else. So wait a minute. If you own a weapon, you go draw your own damn weapon. You turn it in and make sure it's clean. You don't send Marines to draw your weapon. So there was a reason for it. I didn't just pull that out of my rear end. That ticked me off when I saw Marines carrying weapons that belonged to other Marines, particularly leaders. And the only exception I ever made to that was a change of command. If you had a change of command and you're going to go to a reception afterwards, somebody can turn in your sidearm for you. Other than that, you better be in the Army yourself. And that's why armies would get in disarray, because unit leaders weren't in them. They were sending people. They didn't see what the hell was going on in the Army.
You know, sir, one of the things that I walked away with, and again, it was a time that you were at Marine Corps University. One of the things I learned was that techniques are never good or bad. It is the application of the technique to a given situation where it is either misapplied or it's straight up wrongly applied that renders a technique either invalid or poor. And so to me, as I listen to you guys talk, first of all, I don't think I absolutely agree with you. I don't think there's that much daylight at the end of the day when you sit down and listen to what General Zinni's articulating. And I myself, I mean, if lists are appropriate, then publish them. But it's up to the leader to dominate the gray area, and that is the articulating why this is significant to what we do. And if you don't do that, then, you know, what you publish is probably not going to be followed anyway. If you do that, normally Marines are growing as individuals and as leaders.
Right, and a good leader, if they have rules for whatever the situation, there's judgment in their application.
Right.
It's just like doctrine. Doctrine is not dogma. There has to be some wisdom and judgment in the application. And there could be a lot of ways how you implement whatever's laid out with the rule, but it establishes an objective and some idea of what the commander expects.
Got it. All right, sir. That's all I needed from you. I just wanted to...
Can I share a couple more thoughts?
No. You absolutely can. You can stay. We could talk as long as you want. I just don't want to be a boil on your ass.
No. As I tell Marines I see today when I interact with them, and I did when I was in that active duty. I hate rules. I hate lists. I hate maxims. I hate all those things. And I particularly hate the principles of war. They've been debunked for years, yet they're still taught in almost every school. They were deliberately not placed in war fighting, either the first version, FMFM1, or the current version, MCDP1, because the author of that knew that the principles of war were even disowned by one of the early proponents. So, yet we have that out there. So, if you're telling me, if you give me a list, you give me maxims, I shy away from it. But then you got to be careful, because a number of years ago, I got a book from Colin Gray, who's one of the great strategic thinkers of our era. And he sent it to me kindly, and the title is Fighting, 40 Maxims on War, Peace, and Strategy. Fighting Talk is the actual title, Fighting Talk, Colin S. Gray. And I thought, well, I'm kind of surprised, Colin. I think a lot of them would write something like this. I'll kind of scan it, and then I'll send him a nice thank you note. Well, what I found out was it's really 40 essays, short essays, in which he lays out his thoughts on war, peace, and strategy, and every one of those 40 maxims are well worth themselves. It's not like a principle of war. And so in the case of my philosophy of leadership, what I laid out in the document that was called, let me grab it here, make sure I get the right title for you.
All right.
Words of Advice to Subordinates, that's what I saw those. They were, I laid out something, but I provided an explanation of why it was there. It's sort of what Colin Gray did. But if you're talking checklists and those sorts of things, count me out. And certainly count me out on top-down leadership. That's the worst thing that can happen. It's participatory leadership, but we know who the leader is, and we have to hold that leader accountable to making sound decisions and then carrying out their execution. You can't waffle and pass off any shortcomings on those who helped you to come to that decision. You're solely responsible once you make the decision, but it's sort of like wisdom of the crowd. You better have as much good thinking as you can for the difficult problems you'll face in war and peace.
Now that we're going to expand the discussion, so let me ask you this. How long does as a leader, especially as your organization gets bigger, do you go sideways because you're now a commander of other commanders? How long before you snap the rope and say, okay, I'm done doing this dance. This is the way it's going to be. Is that simply, well, that depends on the situation every time? Because at the end of the day, this is a results-driven business. And the more we mess around, the more we allow mediocrity, the higher the casualty counts are going to be. So I'm just curious your thoughts on how long do you dance sideways before you interject yourself or give more rudder steer?
Okay, you've got some sort of a problem or an issue, and you're going to have a discussion, some would say a discourse, with subordinates, with those who provide support to you. And in that discussion, you're going to come to some idea, some story that to you makes sense. And you would hope to the command as a whole, as you tell yourself this story. That's a decision, and you make a decision. Now, if you've got the time, I'll give you an illustration.
Sure.
In Vietnam, I had command of Mike 37. That's when there were four rifle companies in the battalion. Our battalion and a sister battalion in the regiment were having difficulties in their tactical area of responsibilities, term we used at the time, TAORs. Ours was there were a lot of booby traps, what you all would call IEDs today. And they weren't quite as powerful as what the current generation is seeing, but they would take off a leg of a Marine, put out eyes, take off hands. We couldn't seem to solve the problem. A sister battalion was in an area where the VC, the Viet Cong, were firing rockets into Da Nang, and they couldn't seem to stop them. Regimental commander decided to flip the two battalions to put a fresh set of eyes on these problems. Well, I was given a company tactical area of responsibility where most of the rockets were coming from. I had no immediate answer. I don't recall from what then was the Amphibious Warfare School, AWS, now EWS, nor the basic school, any discussions on how you stop somebody from firing rockets. What would happen? The rockets would ripple off and there would be a counter battery fire. It was a waste of time. Because what the VC did was they carried in 15, 20 rockets. They built a ramp out of mud. They had declination instruments so they could get the right angle. they get the right azimuth. They would tie these up to a battery. All those who carried them in would disappear. One VC would stay in a foxhole. At the appropriate time, you'd touch the battery, ripple off these things, and you'd run like hell. So whenever the counter battery came, there was nobody there. So it was a real problem. How do you stop this other than scouting and patrolling? Well, I gathered together the platoon commander, brought the S2 from battalion, brought in the 81, the 105, or the artillery forward observer, brought in what used to call Kit Carson Scouts, who was a Vietnamese who had been a former Viet Cong, and we simply talked about the problem. We didn't follow any damn rules like the military decision-making process or the Marine Corps planning process. They weren't the names then, but they were the similar type things. We didn't follow any of that. We simply talked about it. One of the first things that we discovered in our discussion was that the Viet Cong had never fired rockets during periods of when there was a visibility. Nope, only during periods of reduced visibility. No moon, dark night, never in the daylight, never in a full moon. One of my platoon commanders was sort of a wag, said, "Well, Skipper, if we had 24 hours of daylight, we wouldn't have this problem, would we, sir?" Well, I wasn't too happy with that. No, I like free discussion. That just seemed like a useless comment. And said, "Hey, knock it off, you. Let's get serious." Well, the artillery forward observer shortly after that said, "Captain, could I be excused for a short while?" He said, "I've got to go get something." I said, "Fine, go away. But come back as quick as you can." Took longer than I thought, but when he came back, he had a chart. And it was the astronomical data for that next month. And he had plotted all of the resources we had to fire illumination from our own 60 mortars right up through the 105, 155, and even using C-130s that would drop flares. And he had plotted it so there would never be more than 10 minutes of darkness in our tactical area of responsibility. He had taken away the nighttime from the Viet Cong. Similar, as we talked about it, we found that the only place they could fire these rockets from was a relatively flat, dry piece of land. Couldn't fire them from out of wet paddies, nor could you fire them from underneath the canopy. Platoon commander went away. We had 1 to 25,000 maps. He came back, and he had highlighted every piece of ground in our area of operation that met that criteria, about a 20-meter by 20-meter piece of ground. So what happened, we understood the logic of the problem. And until you understand the logic, there's no counter-logic. Once you understand the logic of what makes it a problem, then a counter-logic emerges. The logic of the problem was they needed a flat piece of ground, and they needed reduced visibility. We took the nighttime and the reduced visibility from them, and we took the flat pieces of terrain by firing the illum and either putting patrols on those pieces of ground or putting our own fires on them. Went 90 days, no rockets fired, where there have been rockets 2 and 3 times a week. Now, that was simply telling us a story that made sense on a freewheeling discussion with all the leaders, and when it came time, I simply made the decision. And now, from that, what do? You give tasks, and from the task with a purpose, you got a mission statement, you write the orders, and you move on. And in today's parlance, that would be called design, if design was done properly.
It's interesting because depending on your level of comfort and command, as you said, some people will give you they don't want to know they don't want to have that discussion, right? And then there's other commanders that, as I think we both know, or you know better than I do, the best commanders you ever worked for, as you said earlier, it's a participatory event. There's no doubt who's in charge. But you feel like you're part of the team, and that this and it pulls you further in when you're having those discussions. And I like the way you paraphrased earlier. It wasn't a list. It was 40 different essays, and you likened that to your rules. There are 21 different essays on leadership and mission accomplishment and how we exist as an organization, so we can go be efficient. Go be efficient in combat. What else haven't I been smart enough to ask you that you want to say about this?
The key is you have everybody participating, And when you have a leader, in my case, invariably, I never found an exception. Don't mean there won't be exceptions. Those who are unwilling to engage that sort of free discussion about professional things were not professionally schooled. They were weak in that area. And the reason that they don't want to have that open discussion, they're not up to engaging in it. And either that or they're uncomfortable in their leadership role, and so they're going to be domineering rather than be part of the team, though the leader of the team.
Interesting. All right, sir. Now, I just want to tease something else that you and I have discussed. You have thoughts on maneuver warfare and the updating of MCDP 1, or can we talk about that for a few minutes?
Sure.
I
think the best description of warfighting, either FMFM 1, the original, or MCDP 1, the current version, I heard General Gray give last week. He gave the inaugural address to the Marine Corps University last week, and I sat in on it. It was on leadership and maneuver warfare. And as he said, it's a philosophy. Because we talk maneuver, many equate it, and particularly in the era when it came about, of large mech units doing sweeping envelopments, that type of thing. No, it's not maneuver in that sense. It's a philosophy, a way of thinking. It's the use of commander's intent. We have a purpose, a reason why, to every task we assign. It's the type of leadership we're talking about. And you can't practice it in wartime, in combat, if you don't practice it in peacetime. There's no such thing as a different style of leadership in peace and war. They're basically the same underpinnings that we're discussing here. Now, when General Gray tasked John Smith, then a young captain, to write the draft for him of warfighting, that was all incorporated. And also with the historical examples. The change between Fleet Marine Force Manual 1 and Marine Corps Doctrine of Public 1 was that the Marine Corps as an institution had begun to understand nonlinear systems, that is, chaotic systems, and war and battles and engagements are all chaotic events. They're nonlinear. They cannot be solved by rule-based systems, talking about rules. You can't go through a step-by-step process and resolve your operational tactical problems. And so what you find in warfighting, the current version, are allusions to what some would call, it's nonlinear dynamics is what it is, but some would call it chaos or complexity theory. And so you see things about systems and how systems will have their own dynamics. If we don't understand that, we fall prey to cliches. A lot of advertisements about battle management systems. That's nonsense. It's as if somebody could manage a battle. I use an analogy. It's like me taking a canoe and going up to the hills in West Virginia, finding a nice stream, and telling folks, I'm going to get in this stream, and I'm going to manage the stream, and I'm going to manage my canoe. No. The stream has its own dynamics. It will unfold in its own way, just like a battle will unfold with its own dynamics. The best you can hope to do is try to manage, and that is not even the right word, but to try to have exercise some sort of control over your unit, recognizing many of the old cliches that no plan survives contact, that you have to be able to adapt continually because you're in this environment that's nonlinear. It's unfolding and changing by the minute. That was the difference between FMFM 1 and MCDP 1. Now, I've thought, along with John Smith, the author of both of those, a lot about what's happened since it was published, getting close to 30 years ago. Your current generation, one many of your listeners are, have learned a lot. And we ought to take what you have learned the hard way these last 30 years. We ought to take what scholars have learned about Clausewitzian theory, Sun Tzu, and his thoughts, even going back and looking at John Boyd, and we ought to see, does the current manual match that experience and match that new scholastic knowledge? I don't think it does. So I would hope to comment on at some point sees the necessity to update. You're not going to change the fundamental ideas, this philosophy of maneuver warfare, but updating it. One example, we spoke of the elements of combat power, fire and maneuver. That's how you bring combat power against the enemy. I think what we've seen here in recent years, probably at least 20, is the use of information as an element of combat power. And I'm not talking about the information that one needs to make a decision. I'm talking about using information against the enemy in terms of deception, or what we used to call psychological operations against the enemy. That's where you're taking information and applying it. So your Fire Support Coordination Center ought to take all three of those elements of combat power and bring together. There's not much discussion of everything from the cyber domain, the cyber arena, in the current manual. We ought to look and add that.
All right, so we're going to work on that a little bit, and then I would love to tee him up and hear you wax eloquent about those. So that was a little tease for everybody. So, sir, first of all, again, I want to thank you. I can't tell you how much I enjoy, whether it's you or General Zinni, this discussion about discipline, which I think is so I think it's so important, because I was just in Camp Pendleton on Saturday. I had somebody tell me a story about a unit that had a suicide issue, or they had a number of suicides in a relatively short period of time. They said, "Look, one of the conclusions was we don't know each other. So what are we going to do? We're gonna play sports. We're gonna compete as a group, a group of 900 plus Marines for 5 days. Hey, sir, we can't do that. We have training. No. We're gonna stop and get to know each other." And one of the comments I don't want to identify the leader, but he got was from PFCs when he said, "What do you think?" And the response was, "This is great, because you know we're getting to talk to higher ups for the first time. They're like talking to us." And and he thought, first sergeants, lieutenants, company commanders. He said, "Who are you talking about?" And they said, "Well, senior lance corporals." And he looked at me and he said, "Are we that broken and that stratified that now in an organization that used to live in squad bays in this idea of closeness and intimacy as warriors, we're now so stratified?" And he said, "It's stunning sometimes how this idea of discipline that we have, this idea of camaraderie and fraternity, has now." I don't think that a lot of Marines realize, a lot of people in the DOD realize, that we bring all this in from our current society, and our current society has very, very little in common with the values of the Marine Corps, the way the Marine Corps lives, and that change is not a 13-week event. That is an ongoing, and I think these discussions are so important, sir, because young leaders listen to them. I had one come up to me Saturday and thank me for these things, and I just want to thank you for being part of it, and I love doing this stuff.
Let me tell you, that kind of worries me, because the best kind of leadership is what we call, used to call, management by walking about, or leading by walking about. And leaders, rather than sit at the desk and see the Marines on the other side of the desk or in some other formal setting, ought to get out about and go to the motor pool, go to the armory, certainly get to the field when training's going on. And I have example after example of what you can do. I remember as the CO of 4th Marines, the squad automatic weapon, the SAW, was a brand new weapon. I had no training on it. I was out in the field watching Marines, and I saw a Marine that was cleaning the weapon. I sat down beside him. He had all spread out in his poncho. And I said, "Marine, do you think you could teach an old colonel how to disassemble and reassemble that weapon?" Well, right away, he took a lot of pride in the fact that he was going to be able to demonstrate to the regimental commander this weapon that he was so proud of. So we spent a little time, and after a while, I successfully disassembled and reassembled it. Now, in the course of that, I asked him what he thought. He said, "Well, sir, it's great as long as you have the drum, but the magazines are terrible." So what do you mean? So we're getting all kind of malfunctions with the magazines. Well, I went back and talked to the regimental ordnance officer, and he said, "Yep, sir, we've filed some information on this to the division." So I went up to the division. Turns out there were three manufacturers of the magazine. Only one of them had a magazine that was satisfactory. Two of them, the magazines were flawed and causing these malfunctions. And I asked them what they'd done. They hadn't done anything. The damn thing was sitting there at the division ordnance officer. So I raised enough hell with the assistant division commander and went back to headquarters Marine Corps. No one would have ever known that. I sure as hell wouldn't if I didn't sit down and talk to that Marine. And I found similar examples. Going in a motor pool, crawl under a vehicle with a Marine. Get out in the field at night and walk the lines and sit in the foxhole and talk to Marines. You'll find out a hell of a lot of things. Get out of the damn office. The Marine Corps was never built for buildings and offices. It was built to be a combat unit in the field. Get out there with them.
If I told you that companies have two company formations a week, and I heard this and I was stunned by it, but I heard it from my son because it was his company. They had two company formations a week. The rest of the time the platoons ran themselves. And I looked at him and I said, I cannot fathom a Marine Corps that where the company first sergeant are not looking at staff NCOs, NCOs, the Marines, two or three times, multiple times a day, wire brushing, having a good time. But that group, that organization, and that gathering of that group, there's a lot of stuff that goes on. And it's not just passing information. There's a lot of different ways you can do that. And now you're doing it via text message. That's great. And that's a technique that maybe you could use. But when you stop gathering, when the most senior enlisted guys in the company are not seeing people multiple times on a daily basis, and they don't know McNamara, who runs this suck all the time, all of a sudden McNamara is really quiet. Hey, McNamara, after this, you come see me. And that's how the Marine Corps has always existed. And General Zinni told a really interesting story to me about being General Haynes' aide at 2nd Marine Division. And the commandant, General Barrow, had come down. And so he's sitting in the front seat of those old green Govies, I think. And they're riding around Camp Lejeune. And he said, and I'm listening, and General Barrow is really worried about taking the Marine Corps out of squad base. And he said, but, you know, we've gone to the all-volunteer force, and we're trying to raise the standard of living, and the other services are going to them, and we've got to be competitive, and yada, but I think we're going to destroy the soul of the Marine Corps. And General Zinni said, you know, we've been trying to save the same spirit of the squad bay as we've moved out of it. But I don't know if you reach a point of no return where if your senior guys aren't leading everybody, enlisted guys aren't leading everybody on a daily basis, who's leading them? Novices are leading them? And I don't know how that works, sir, and I'd be curious about your thoughts.
Well, a couple of things come to mind. Usually you don't get this kind of a spirit until the end of a unit's life. I mean by that, if you're a unit that's going to be on the unit deployment program, towards the end you have that kind of spirit. I think what you need to do is at the front end, do things that kind of give you that spirit. Now, two examples. I was chief of staff of the 3rd Division out in Okinawa, and usually after the final exercise in the spring, that staff would be a good, effective, efficient, functioning unit, and everybody knew each other. Well, I said, why do we wait till the end? So when the end of the summer rolled around and we'd done all the turnovers, I would take the staff up to Korea for a command post exercise. And first of all, we got out of the office. We got away from all the routine, mundane things that happened in garrison. And we got out in the field, and we lived in the field. And we spent about a week up there. Well, we came back, and all of a sudden, I began to see that same sort of camaraderie that we'd seen at the end of the year before, because we were out there doing something together. And I can see the example of sports. You could do the same thing. When I took command at Quantico, the morning after I took command of the unit, I took the staff and we went on a canoe trip. I said, I can't think of a better way. First of all, I wanted to emphasize that we need people to work hard, but we need people to play hard too. So if I take over command in the first morning, we can go on a canoe trip with the command's staff. Then that ought to send a signal to the rest of the folks of what we're talking about. And it was a short daytime trip, but and we went out and we sat around and talked professional things, had some chow, came back. It began to bring the staff together in this kind of manner you're talking about.
Sir, again, I can't thank you enough for doing this. I truly appreciate it, and I will be in touch, and we'll begin to develop the idea for talking about your thoughts on maneuver warfare and how it's moved in 30 years, and we'll get that together.
I look forward to it. Thank you.
There you have it. Lieutenant General Paul Van Riper here. Don't touch that dial. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. How about that for not a bad way to spend a couple hours on a Tuesday? Listen to a couple of well-thought leaders in the Marine Corps who between them probably have about close to 80 years of leadership. Honestly, I have one of the coolest jobs in the world. Between this stuff and post-traumatic winning, come on. Who's cooler than me? Nobody. After we got off the air, General Van Riper was telling me, he goes, hey, Mac, I got to tell you. He said, I was just up in Quantico, and I can't tell you the number of people that have come up and mentioned the interview that we did. He said, I didn't realize that many people listened. So, no, this is a great tool. It's becoming a great tool, to influence. And it's always intellectually to hear these guys talk about discipline that goes back to their days as lieutenants and captains and whatnot. I mean, it's the best. So don't touch that dial. If, hour one, I'm concerned, to be honest with you, how much of our popular culture, how much of the no consequence, no adversity, everybody gets an award, we don't want to hurt your feelings, can we allow in the active duty United States or the United States military? Because there's a definite difference in what the culture that locates, closes with, and destroys enemies of the United States embraces and has to embrace. And individuality on your own time, no consequences, and don't be mean to me. Don't stick your foot up my ass. And let me tell you, and it's already encroached. So you'll hear me discuss that a little bit in the first hour, and then stay tuned. If you're just tuning in, you'll hear General Zinni talking about another on discipline segment, and you'll hear him. And then you just heard General Van Riper at the end of General Zinni, because it appears that General Zinni and General Van Riper are at odds. But truth be told, they're not. I think both of them will tell you that how important it is that as a leader, you articulate your vision of what you're doing. Yeah. That you articulate that. And then, once you articulate it, you've got to make sure they understand all the footnotes. Now, I think General Zinni's style is get out there, present combat concepts, teach people, and he wants to grow that thing bottom up. I would tell you that General Furness and General Van Riper do the same things, but they published what they thought in what they call rules. Now, both of them would summarily reject the notion of, you know, top-down leadership. They would, and you heard General Van Riper say, it's not how I do it. I can tell you, having worked for him, it's not how General Furness does it. So I love this discussion, this nuanced discussion of, this is what I did, this is how I, these are the footnotes, this is why it makes sense. And then bringing somebody else on and say, well, this is what I did, I don't see it exactly like that, this is the footnotes as I see it, and then reconciling for yourself. I love that kind of stuff. All right. As do they. So, and then the good news is that hopefully we'll get a few roundtables with General Van Riper, General Zinni, waxing eloquent about whatever they want to. And I'll sit here and throw switches. So, anyway, my thanks to General Zinni for spending, she spent close to 3 hours with me that day recording that interview. And then my thanks to General Van Riper
for his graciousness in terms of coming on and talking and whatnot. So anyway, we're going to take a break because I forgot to hit the save button on the first hour. So we'll take a quick break, and then you'll hear the first hour. More of All Marine Radio coming up next on this Tuesday, the 8th day of October. As almost to noon, for God's sakes. What the hell? So don't touch that dial. More of this program coming up next, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. But just so you know, this part of the show is over and out.